Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. So I was just thinking, if climate change, the warming of the earth, causes more hurricanes, then does not the lack of hurricanes mean that the earth is actually cooling? I mean, it's just a thought, right? Because this is what we keep hearing, that climate change, the warming of the earth, the increase in CO2, which of course is nonsense. I mean, it's just total nonsense. But you notice when there aren't a lot of hurricanes, they don't say anything. They don't say, well, you know what? The opposite is also true, you know, that the earth must be cooling because we don't have any hurricanes. Now, I don't wish hurricanes. I'm not trying to say we should have hurricanes. I'm not trying to project hurricanes, call them up, conjure them, or anything like that. No, I'm just saying that it's amazingly absent. This is quite a calm year. And it's a good thing. Hurricanes are necessary for the earth, but they're not but they're a terrible thing because people get hurt. So let me ask, now that Tara D's on the line, I'm going to ask her exactly the same question as I started off. Tara D, have you noticed that there's not, and this is a good thing, by the way, not a lot of hurricanes. We've had one, and that one was bad enough, but I'm just saying, but a lot of times we'll have 10, you know,
and
September's the worst month for hurricanes. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I noticed this year has been a lot, knock on wood, a lot slower, and we're very happy about that, for sure.
Yeah, I'll knock on some wood, too, even if it's plywood, composite, whatever they call this stuff.
A little bit of wood in there, right, yeah.
But the point is that if the environmental wackos are screaming and yelling that if there are more hurricanes, that means that there's climate change, that the earth is warming up, does this not mean that when there are fewer hurricanes, the earth is actually cooling down, and that's a good thing?
If that were the case, I would say that would be a good thing, but I don't know enough about it to comment.
Oh, we can always speculate. We do that all the time. Listen, if I didn't comment on all the things I don't know enough about, I wouldn't even have a radio show. I'm uniquely unqualified for pretty much everything I do here. I really am. Yeah. I don't have a broadcast degree, don't have a communications degree. I have an economics bachelor, but certainly not a PhD. I don't have a law degree. I've never run for office. there's a ton of things that I've never done, but here I am with a radio show, you know, so who knows. No,
right.
I
will tell you, after this summer, though, I was like, okay, it was like one of the worst summers ever, I think. So I was like, yeah, okay, we'll believe whatever you say. If you just get the temperature down, we'll do whatever you want. It was just so brutal. Hey, leave that alone. We've got a puppy in the office this morning, and he is already trying to break into different items this morning. So
I didn't think you're yelling at me, so that's okay.
Okay.
But I need to make you a theme, so I'm gonna be. I think this is like theme weekend. I need one for you, for Bonnie, for Bianca. So I have to get caught up on my themes now that you've all been here for enough time for me to kind of get a feel for how to create a theme for everybody. But that's the next thing. But yeah, the climate is fascinating. Let's talk about the critters. How did they do this summer? Because this really was brilliant.
So this summer was probably the worst, or one of the worst, that since I've been here, and I've been here for many a day. So we had a lot of dogs that actually got overheated. So we were basically shuffling dogs around in offices to give them a break from the heat. We were ordering cooling mats and cooling blankets for the dogs, and we kind of did a donation drive for that. So the public really, really stepped up and helped with that and supported and sent those in for us. But the dogs go through those a lot because some of the dogs will chew. So they're pretty pricey items to have to come in and then just only get to use temporarily and toss. So that was frustrating for us to see, you know, but hey, dogs chew. So it's kind of like you just have to make them as comfortable as you can and hope that they are realizing that that's something to help them. We also just noticed a lot of dogs they don't want to get out and run around when it's so hot. Some of them will, but some are like, nope, just leave me be. And we were actually having to restrict our dog walking hours because we had so many dogs getting overheated, and so we just wanted to maintain their safety. And so that was the first that we've had to do that, and so we're just really glad the temperatures are getting a little lower so we can kind of go back to regular activity here at the shelter. Another thing that we did, and we've done this for a few years now, is we have a volunteer. We basically called it the ice baby thing. She would go next door and fill up a big cooler full of ice and bring it back and drop it in the water of the dogs. And so either a volunteer or staff member has maintained that throughout the summer as well. Cause it's just like a little thing, because even their water was getting hot because it was just so hot.
Right, right. Right.
And
well, it absorbs the ambient temperature.
Yeah, it was
so, yeah,
terrible.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Absolutely. But we actually got some help from the public this year, a couple different AC companies, and I should know, but I don't know right off the top of my head, came in and helped do some finagling to where they got some blowers in there, and then the county ordered this big AC blower thing. I don't know if it's technically an air conditioner or just some sort of apparatus, you know, a cooler of some sort. But anyway, so that has helped get the temperatures where they are manageable. So instead of, you know, being like, you know, it may still be 80 in the kennels, but 80 is doable. So so that's just helped tremendously. But, yeah, it was probably one of the worst summers that I've seen since, you know, many, many years as far as the heat. So we're glad that it's starting to wind down and we're getting a little break from that.
Yeah, you should get a company to donate solar panels that also create shade for the dogs. So if the dogs are ever in the sunshine, you know, you could get a twofer.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
For solar panels for heating and cooling, and especially if a company donates, they'll get a big name for themselves. And you, anybody that donates to Santa Rosa County Animal Shelter is welcome on the show. So if you want to help a sponsor out, feel free. You know, you can always bring them on.
Oh, okay, that's awesome.
I believe in rewarding good work. Yeah. But but if you have any place that needs shade, you know, use solar panels for shade. And again,
oh, yeah,
you can use that to help
idea.
On the shelter. Yeah, yeah. Well,
yeah, two for one. That's a wonderful thought.
That's what I do here. I should get a PhD in ideas.
That's kind of right. A think tank PhD.
Well, I don't think of myself as a tank, but I guess I know what you're meaning. You meant well. Do you ever like get a garden hose and just like, you know, mist the dogs down or something like that? Go like a fine spray and just kind of mist them? And cause
yes, we have
that
done
evaporate.
That. We have done that as well and just kind of gone through. And some of them are like, oh, yes, you know, and some of them like to play in the water, so they just enjoy it. But we try not to do it where it's going to scare them. But if they're interested in getting cooled off, you know, and if dogs are getting – and we did do that this summer because it was just – yeah, it was a rough summer. So we would go through and we cleaned the kennels and we usually put them in when we clean and then let them back out so they kind of have the indoor-outdoor section. But then after that, yeah, we – you know, go through, and if anybody looks like, oh, a little nice spray will cool them off and they're about it, then, yeah, we run through. We have a couple dogs that love to play in the water, so they're always, you know, about that. And then we have the little baby pools, the kitty pools out there.
The duck dogs, they'll probably
look and some of our bully mixes are really, really fond of the water as well. And then our play yards, we do have the kiddie pools out there, so you'll see some of the dogs just completely ignore them, while others literally go and just, you know, lay in the water the whole time they're outside. And then some will just kind of frolic about or drink out of it and go. So it's kind of neat to see, you know, the different dogs that love that, and the other dogs are like, no, thank you, don't want to get my paws wet.
Oh, the prissy dogs. That's funny. I never thought about it that way. So let's get some breeds. Let's name names here. Who are the water dogs and who are the prissy dogs?
The ones that we see here, obviously the labs always generally tend to water, love the water. The bully mixes seem to really dig the water. When we take little dogs out, we don't get them very often anymore, the small dogs, but they don't seem to be too interested in getting into the pool. We did have a Yorkie here. This was many years ago, but she had kind of long, fluffy hair in the top, and she was very energetic. And so we named her Tina Turner, and because she just had that fight personality, and she had the wild hair, you know. And that little dog loved to play in the water. So I guess it just depends on the particular dog. But as a whole... You know, the retrievers are probably the top dogs that love the water that we see.
Yeah, I just think the Bichon Frise don't want to mess up their hairstyle, their hairdo.
Oh, yeah. They're like, no, sorry, I just got my hair done last week, so can't get it wet.
It's amazing what you can do with a hairdryer and a Bichon, anyway.
Yeah, it's really neat. And, you know, our dogs don't look that fancy in general, but we have had some, you know, some purebred dogs. We get purebred dogs often, but generally they're the bigger breeds. But throughout the years, we have had... Just about, I mean, we've even had Afghan Hound here before, believe it or not.
Wow.
So, yeah, so but we don't see as many of the unique breeds anymore. It's more, you know, just a lot of mixes is what we get.
Are they not as popular
know.
Or people don't are owning them?
Well, I know that we
expensive?
Don't take owner surrenders. Yeah, as a rule, we don't take owner surrenders now when we used to, but I don't even see them out and about anymore. So I'm not real sure if just the breed, I guess the breed choices you know, kind of changed throughout the year. So when you see, you know, when we had certain movies, we were seeing an uptake of Dalmatians, and then it was Huskies for a while. And it kind of goes with whatever the movie, the popular movie is. Sometimes at the time you'll see a lot more of those. Or if there's a, you know, like the Belgian Malinois are very popular right now, which is probably terrible because they are so intelligent and very focused, and it's usually not a dog you want for your just the average pet owner who's not going to put in the work. So
what was the breed name?
Belgian Malinois. So those are police dogs generally.
That's Conan, you know. Right? That's the one that went in and got El Baghdadi that Trump was talking about. Conan was a Belgian Wuzzer, whatever you call it.
Oh, okay. I'm not familiar with that, but probably so, yeah, because they, you know, a lot of police work is what they're kind of known for, or security work. But I think, you know, the sheriff's departments and whatnot have kind of switched over to them as a whole from the shepherds, because they have a little less injury, but they're super hyper-focused, super intelligent, but they are, yeah, that's a lot of dog. So you have to be committed if you're going to have them as a pet.
Shepherds are probably too injured at this point, right?
Yeah, shepherds at this point have a lot of, like, hip and, you know, that's another thing. Anytime you are getting a purebred dog, you want to, if you're going to use a breeder, definitely make sure it's a reputable breeder, and you definitely need to check into those things, getting the hips and elbows certified and things like that, because those are very important for your dog's health. And you want to make sure that, you know, that you're going to get a dog that's actually a legitimate, you know, healthy dog, because it's really tough to have a dog that's got a lot of health issues. It's tough on them as well.
They should exchange. I mean, breeders, you know, if you're a German Shepherd breeder, you should exchange, you know, I don't know, send, you know, genetic material, shall we say, you know, from like a breeder in Germany or a breeder in, Kenya or a breeder in Australia. I mean, just they should be sharing it. They should mix those German Shepherds with as many different German Shepherds as they could to kind of, would that improve the genetics? Because if you just keep inbreeding within an area, is it regionalized that you see?
I think that it just depends on the breeder, because I know, like, in the past, when I worked at a vet's office years ago, one of our clients was a German Shepherd breeder, and she actually was from Germany, and so she would do that. She would use a stud from, like, her home, and you know what I mean? So it wasn't like
word.
She wasn't...
I was trying to think of a good word. Thank you.
So she would kind of do that, and so that she had a really good line, and then if there were any problems with any of her dogs, she would get them altered and not breed them anymore, which is the responsible thing. And so, but I mean, pretty much if there's any breed that you want at this point in time, you can find it at a rescue, unless you're just really set on a specific, you know, I know people are in love with the puppies, but guess what? You only have a few months of puppy time, and then they're going to be an adult anyway. So skip the puppy part, go directly to the adult part, get them from a rescue, and 9 times out of 10, they can already tell you their good points, bad points. They can be house trained already. So you kind of skip, and puppy part is fun, but it's a lot of pee and poo, honestly. So it's not the worst thing in the world to miss out on that part of their life, you know, because you have several more years of a good companion. So I just always, you know, remind people, like, we wanted a puppy. Well, it's not going to be a puppy in 4 months. So why don't you take a look at the adult dogs, because you might find an awesome dog, you know, that's already grown, but amazing.
Yep, and 5-year-olds need adopting, too, for people. So you don't have to get a baby.
Hey,
like,
get out of there.
2 hours
oh,
old.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. That's
yeah,
okay.
So
anyway,
speaking
I'm
of puppies, we have this puppy in the office, and so I guess when someone put him in our office last night, they didn't put him in a crate. Well, he's 4 months old, so he destroyed our office, got stuff off the tables and the counters. The keyboard was on the floor, the mouse. He got into some treats. He got shredded some paper and just made it all-around disaster when we came
time.
In this morning.
Yeah,
so he had a fun time. Yeah, and so now he's still walking around looking for stuff to get into. So, but he's very cute, so, you know, you
I'm
can't
sure.
get on to him too much.
Well, I can't wait till the discussion you have with the person that forgot the crate, but then we'll save that for another time. You have to tell me what happens. I was going to ask you something about, I guess, back to dog question and heat one more time, then we can get to the critters that are out there. Will a dog run itself to exhaustion? I mean, heat, you know, heat conditions can be fatal, heat stroke, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Some dogs will. And so that's why you as the adult, kind of like your children, sometimes your kids will do stupid things in the name of fun. So dogs will do the same. Some dogs know how to self-regulate and they're like, okay, I'm tired. But other dogs that have like a strong drive, they will not stop. And so you really have to be the person that says, okay, that's enough. Let's go inside. I personally have a rescue dog, a Rottweiler, and he will, if there's four wheelers in the neighborhood and he hears them, he goes bonkers and he will run himself. Probably he would burn himself to death. I wouldn't be surprised. Like, so if we're outside and we hear that, I give him an amount of time and then I'm like, okay, go inside, because he will not stop. And with the heat and just the constant cardio going, running back and forth, like, a dog could run themselves out or get overheated. So we definitely, as the responsible parties that we allegedly are, we have to, remind them, like, hey, let's go inside, get them to take a break, make sure that you're on top of that. Because even though, like we said, the temperatures are going down, it's still very, very hot, and dogs can easily get overheated, especially in the Florida sun. So just want to stay on top of that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too. I was thinking that by horses, because I know horses have been known to run to exhaustion and literally collapse and die. You know, so I don't imagine be different for dogs as well. Although some horses, I was watching a movie the other day, the horse just stopped, just stood there. Well, your horse is done. You know, just standing there. It's like, okay, not running any further.
Like, I'm over it.
Yeah. Okay, that's it. That's all you get. Get a camel. They can actually run further, which is kind of interesting. No, there was a famous race in Australia. Someone bet that their horse could beat their camel over a 100-mile race. And the horse won, barely, and then it collapsed and died. And the camel this is years and years ago. The horse ran itself, to exhaustion and so I guess expired overnight. The camel, as they say, got a good night's sleep, got up and ran 100 miles back the next day. So the camels are pretty amazing. I know we don't see them here.
Yeah, they're really fascinating because they just look so they're just meandering along, but really they can get it pretty quickly. Yeah, pretty neat.
Yeah, they're like the Ever-Ready Bunny of animals. They just keep going and going. And
except for that whole spitting thing, but I guess that's a lot of those.
Well, I've ridden a camel. Camels are hysterical.
Get out of there. Stan.
Welcome back.
Sorry.
He's
being super bad this morning.
Tara is babysitting a puppy in her office. So that's what's going on. So this is live radio. This is what makes it fun. Okay. So I can entertain while you're busy. I'll just fill in.
Yeah, it's been a little night this morning. But, Dan is available for adoption, as anyone can tell.
No,
they're
kidding.
Probably like, oh, he sounds like a troublemaker. But he's just a puppy, so he's into everything, and that's pretty normal for puppies. So you just have to be prepared, like having a crate. You want to crate them when you're not home so that they're safe and so that your things are safe. And that's with any
office.
Little puppy.
Yeah,
if he's in the office, definitely crate him. So he's looking all innocent now, but yeah, they can get into things. But this little guy, he's actually available for adoption. He's already altered, and he's about 4 months old. He's super, super sweet, very cuddly,
and
very loving. He's just a mixed breed. He's probably got some bully in him, I guess, but it's not. That's
bully. What's bully?
Some sort of bulldog. It could be who knows
bulldogs,
what. Because there's so many bulldog breeds that are just kind of all mixed in today. These days, it's just kind of hard to tell exactly
without
a DNA test, you really couldn't. Yeah. Because people just, so in this area, we have a lot of backyard breeders. So just who knows what gets thrown in the woodshed. So, but he's really sweet and cute. He's a handsome puppy. And he's very inquisitive and checking things out. So. But it would be a lot of fun for someone.
What should people do? Is backyard breeding, are we talking about legal but not necessarily ethical? Are we talking illegal? Or what kind of folks are
well,
doing
technically
this,
it's not illegal, but it's if you're going to purposely breed, you should be doing it if you're going to even do it, which that's a whole other debate. But if you're going to purposely have a litter, you need to make sure that, A, your dog is like super, like it should be a promotion of the breed, not just because your dog's cool, but or I want to see what their puppies would look like. It's supposed to be for the betterment of the breed. And your breed, if you just are purposely allowing your mixed breed dog to have puppies, you're not bettering anything. All you're doing is putting her through unnecessary labor, and then you're taking a chance on her health, and you're putting puppies out into the world that probably, have less of a chance of getting a home because they're a mixed breed. So it's not... mixed breeds are great dogs and they're cute, but we have so many of them. So There's no need to purposely do that. There's just so many dogs without homes. So, you know, just encourage people to think about that before they, you know, and also just not being a responsible pet owner is another big problem of people just not getting their animals fixed, and then they have an oops litter, so to speak. And then you've got 8 or 9 puppies. And even if they find homes for those 8 or 9 puppies, well, now there's 8 or 9 more puppies out there that are not altered. And so someone got them for free.
And they're
going to
grow up and have their own generations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's the cycle continues. So that's why it's like, hey, if you're going to be a pet owner, try to figure out a way to get that animal spayed or neutered. And it can be very expensive, and I get that, but there are low-cost programs in the area. So we do have a list of resources here for folks if they're interested and need help to try to help them find the right place to get that done.
Can people call you in advance, say, hey, I was thinking of breeding my pet. Do you have advice for me? Is that something they can talk to you guys about?
I will tell them not to do it.
Okay, that's fine. And that's a good answer.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's what I was wondering. So, okay.
Yeah, I mean, all if right. people call for advice, we don't give veterinary advice, obviously. But if someone, if they call and let's say they are thinking about, oh, I'm thinking about getting a particular dog or something, and we'll tell them the information that we know, you know, like, hey, this breed, what we see here at the shelter, or this is something we've noticed, you know, we can't tell you everything about a dog, but any information that we have, we're definitely glad to share. Or if we say somebody asks about, you know, homeowners insurance is an issue for some people because they won't allow certain breeds. So some people may come in and be like, hey, I'm looking for to adopt a dog, but I need to make sure it's on my list and I'm allowed to have it. So if they, you know, if they decide to come in, we would try to help them choose a dog that would fly on their list of you know, breeds that they could have.
Renters too. A lot of times people who rent apartments, some landlords welcome dogs, some charge a security deposit, and some don't want pets at all. So
exactly.
as people are moving,
exactly.
that's an issue also. Yeah. Okay.
And I don't really think that dogs are going to do any more damage than children will. Honestly, I mean, I'm a pet person. I don't have children, but like I've seen my friends' children, and they can do some damage too. So I think, you know, pet, as long as somebody pays a pet deposit, like, and they're a responsible pet owner, you know, even as an owner, you know, a landlord, like maybe you do with some extra check-ins or something to ensure that they're doing what they need to do and not damaging your property. But, you know, ultimately, people need pets. So that's what we saw when all the prices went up. A lot of landlords were like, okay, no, when they would re-rent out, they would decide you can't have a pet. So a lot of people were getting displaced with their pets or having to rehome their pets. And that's really, really unfortunate because, you know, people get attached to their pets, and that's something they don't want to have to do, for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a whole new topic we should probably spend more time on. Okay, as usual, we're running out of time. So let's get the critters that are around, and then at the end we'll give all the contact information.
Okay. Yeah, so we like I said, we have Dan here in the office. Tomorrow we're going to be at PetSmart in Pace, Florida. So we're going to be there from 11 till 2. We are going to have the first 10 adoption fees waived. So it's a great time to come and adopt because someone else is going to be footing the bill for you. And we have puppies that are going to be there, several puppies, probably 10 or so puppies. And we're going to have some adult dogs too. So it should be a fun day. We're excited, and hopefully, you know, we're going to have lots of adoptions tomorrow. So that's what we're hoping for. And
You need to make a video. You need to make a Facebook video, put it live on your Facebook page, then I can share it.
Yes.
So we want to see all those cute puppies and kitties. We want to see all those things. But videos, I'm finding videos extremely useful. And so I will be doing more of them. How'd that video go that we made? Did that get a decent response? Has it been on the Facebook page for a while?
I don't know. I know that we had fun with it here at the shelter, but we sent it over to next door. So I kind of didn't really, I don't know if they're using it for clips or what, but we should do another one soon when Miss Vicky comes back. She's out for a little bit. So when she comes back, we'll have to get her involved. So she's a lot of fun.
Well, maybe I'll show up myself. So this is PetSmart, and this is in Pace, Florida, which is somewhere between Pensacola and Milton, for those that might be actually traveling into the area here. So and there's only one PetSmart in Pace, right? So it's easy to find.
Correct.
One
yeah, there's only one.
That.
There's Milton and Pace. That's the only one. So if you go on Highway 90, you'll see it. It's over in the Target Shopping Center. So we'll be over there 11 till 2. We'll have our van there that will have animal services on it, so you should be able to spot that in the parking lot, and I think we'll have some really cute faces there.
I may even show myself and do a video. You never know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on out.
A lot of projects.
Yeah, we're gonna try to do a little live tomorrow, like you said, just to show who we have there. That way, if everyone wants to check out our Facebook page, and they can get a peek of who we have there, and see if they want to come down. If they see a face, if they can't resist, they can come on down and meet them.
Tag me. That way, I can find you if I forget, because Saturdays a lot of times, most of the week shows are kind of prepped or thought about on Saturday. There's a tremendous amount of prep that goes in, because I have the whole day to work on my show, so I do.
Right.
All right. More critters. We got some kitties. And we have more dogs.
Yes. Actually, we're slow on kitties right now. We got a lot of adoptions. I think we have a couple at PetSmart, and then we're waiting on. I believe we have two litters that are going to be incoming next week that we're excited about. These are. Just to mention them, so if anybody's looking, they're about 4 months old and kind of like a little fluffy medium hair kitty. So those guys have just gotten their shots. So we're waiting for them to have their first round of shots. We'd like to wait and make sure they're healthy, and then they'll come in. And then I think as far as adults, we really have the only one I can think of that's still here, but he's an amazing cat. His name is Link. He is a beautiful orange tabby, kind of a fluffy guy. He came in super, super scared and just really fearful of everybody, and he's just come around so amazingly. He's so loving, and he makes biscuits, and he loves to cuddle, and he loves his bed, and he's just a sweetheart. So if anyone is a cat person, he's an adult cat, but he's awesome. So I would encourage people to look at our Facebook or our website, look at his face, because you're going to fall in love with him. Even if you're not a cat person, you're going to fall in love with this guy. He's adorable. So if you're looking for an awesome cat, I would come down and meet Link here at the shelter.
Yeah. I think if I had a cat, I could, take on adventures. Do people take their cats with them camping and parks and walking? And I don't know how you walk a cat.
Some people do. Not as much as dogs, obviously, but there are some people that travel with their cats, and they use the little backpacks, and they kind of look like a little moon thing or something. It's got a little cover there. Some cats really enjoy it. I've seen different videos of people like doing some heavy traveling with their cats, and the cat kind of goes everywhere with them. So, it just depends on the cat. A lot of cats maybe wouldn't be cool with that, but maybe if they were brought up as a traveler and, when they were a kitten, maybe they're used to it and it's not so big a deal. And then some people do walk their cats on harnesses as well, and that's probably another thing you'd probably have to start out as a kitten to get them used to it. But we do have harnesses here that we give out to people if we have a few kitten harnesses. And so we actually sent a little kitty home yesterday with a kitten harness. So they were excited to try to see if they could get their kitty harness trained so they could take her on walks.
Do they have like little GPS things on your animals? If they ever go running around a park or something like that?
People are using AirTags now for that, and it's really helped people.
What is that?
It's the little, it's something from Apple AirTags. And you can put it, on your luggage so you can see where your luggage is, because it's basically like the Find My iPhone app where you can see where your iPhone is, and that little tag is going to show up. So this is a little tag, a little clip that you put. You can put it on your luggage. People put them on their dog's collars, and they use them as a device of tracking their dog. So if their dog's loose, they can tell, the vicinity of where the dog is. So it's really kind of neat. And I think there's probably specific marketing tools for that nowadays, but I know a lot of people were using the AirTags for that, and you can get them on Amazon, I think, and they're relatively inexpensive. And that's it was a way people were tracking their dogs. I don't know about cats, since we don't,
No, I think for dogs,
they use the breakaway collars. But
if they get out the door, and they start running down the neighborhood, where's the dog? So that you
it's
can.
It's let me pull out my phone. Okay, he's at Uncle Martin's house, two streets over. Let's go pick him up. So, and
microchipping is cats too.
Yeah,
they'd be a great thing for outdoor cats. Okay.
Yeah, if there's a way to get it where, because we want to make sure that with the cats, the breakaway collars are important so they don't get with them jumping over fences and whatnot to make sure they don't get caught. So.
Okay. Well, we better give the contact information just in case.
Okay, absolutely. So Santa Rosa Animal Services, we are at 4451 Pine Forest Road, Milton, Florida. Our number is 850-983-4680. Our website is santarosa.fl.gov/animals. And you can also check out our Facebook page, Santa Rosa County Animal Services.
Okay, and we might have a minute or so before Derek gets here. So if you have any other critters or any other news, now is the time.
Okay, yeah. So we sometimes partner with some of our local groups. So Pensacola mm-hmm. Humane Society is going to be taking some of our dogs this week to help us out because we are so overcrowded. So a few of our good boys and girls will be going over there. So if you're in Pensacola and maybe you don't want to make the trip all the way to Milton, we encourage you to go check out Pensacola Humane Society at their events over the weekend. We're sending some amazing dogs over there that are just not really getting seen over here, and we hope that will help them get adopted. But they are nothing wrong with the dogs. They're some of our favorites. But, you know, sometimes a different location helps an animal get adopted. So we're excited about that and appreciate their partnership. And what else we have? Oh, next week we're going to be going to Petco in Pensacola. So we're excited about that as well. So we've got events probably every 3 out of 4 weekends coming up for the fall. So we're super excited to get out and see the public and meet the community and show off our dogs and cats.
Do we ever have dog shows around here or cat shows or any of those kind of things?
I know that we have had some in the past, but I don't really remember seeing anything in the last couple of years, maybe since COVID. I know that there were some dog shows that they used to have, like, at the what is that place on Nine Mile Road, the Shriners Temple. I think they've had them there before, and I think they've had something at the – yeah. And I believe they've had a couple things at the Equestrian Center as well. So those are – yeah, and usually –
the Equestrian Center. Yeah. Yes, thank you very much. Yeah,
so I think there's a Five Flags Dog Training Club, and I think from what I remember, they used to post everything on their site kind of to the community. So it's always neat to go to something like that. You get to see different breeds that you're not familiar with, so it's a fun time.
Yeah, I actually ended up watching a dog show just for that reason, to see all the different dog breeds. There's some amazing breeds out there. I mean, you know, you think of basic wolf, coyote, you know, the basic dog, the original dogs, and they've just gone crazy. You know, you've got little dogs to big dogs,
Yeah, just to think, you know, of the chihuahuas and whatnot, and you're like, whoa, this came from a wolf. Like, how did this happen?
Well, that's a good question. We'll say that Derek's here right now, so let's save it for next time. How did that happen? Tell me, if you're interested in a little research project, tell me how that happened. Let's start with wolves and coyotes and kind of like do it. Let's do a little ancestry.com tracing of dogs and how they got to where they are. And then we can do cats, because cats haven't changed that much. You know, your basic house cat isn't that different than a bobcat.
They just kind of miniature size, but other than that, they're pretty much, they look the same. It's funny because you can see, you know, like kittens of big cats, and they look pretty much like a normal kitten or cat, but just, you know, just a little upsized. But, the dogs have kind of gone a whole different direction now.
Now, the South American cats, the ocelots and the margays. Margays are about the size of a house cat. Ocelots are a little bigger. Bobcats in the United States, you know, are little, of course, they don't have the tail. They're a little bit bigger, but they're pretty ferocious. But they're not huge. They're not like lions and tigers. So let's have some fun with this. Let's start with dogs next week, if you're interested. And let's say, how did we get from wolf to chihuahua? That would be
That's a good school project for some kids if they're into animals. I bet it'd be really, really, you know, a lot of information and cool facts.
Okay, thank you, Tara. Well, let's do it next week.
Okay, thanks, and y'all have a good weekend.
All right,
bye-bye.
You too. Money. What is it? How does it work? How do you get it to work for you? So many choices: stocks, bonds, mutual funds, commodities. And then there are the markets: oil, gold, manufacturing, trade, energy, even government. To make sense of all the places your money can go, Derek Park, our Action Radio financial reporter, joins us Fridays at this time to make sense of the markets and your money. So what do you think, Derek? Would you let you hear a little ancestry story from wolf to chihuahua? I just thought of that.
I hear you, man.
Yeah, well, this is spontaneous live radio, so anything that pops into my head just kind of comes out there. So how are you doing this week?
Good. It's been a little busy week, but, hasn't been a bad week, I guess, considering the markets.
Well, that's what I'm curious about. In fact, I talked to Derek off the air about some things. I'm curious about real estate because a friend was concerned about that, inflation and that kind of stuff. And then this morning I heard a report, and this is where I want to start. The United Auto Workers has called a strike at all the big three. That would be GM, Chrysler, and Ford. And I had to think about that for a minute. And they've got a new tactic called the stand-up strike. So they don't tell where they're going to strike. They just, you know, have an entire department just stop working. And they've done, of course, the big ones, the Jeeps, the pickup trucks, and whatever else. Of course, they haven't done electric cars. No one's striking at the electric plants. That's kind of funny. But the fact that they're doing that, they're striking, and they're asking, and this is the part that, that killed me, 46% pay increase over 4 years. That's huge.
Wow.
And the airlines have requested the same thing, and they may have gotten it. But here's what I'm thinking. So, and I think I posted this on Facebook, but I'll ask you the same question, is that if this administration is saying there is no inflation, then how can these people ask for a 46% pay increase? And if they're asking for a 46% pay increase and the Democrat government says that's absurd, you can't have that, then how can they say they're for working families? So there's a real catch-22. This is a fascinating situation. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I heard a good thing from a CEO, and I can't remember who it was specifically, and he says, listen, he says, you know, I'll agree that you know, we need to increase people's pay. He says, but right now during inflation, if we increase people's pay, he's like, all you're going to do is make inflation worse. He says, because, you know, while we're happy to pull whatever it is they feel or whatever the government feels that they should, he says, you have to understand that that's going to be passed directly to the consumer. He says,
well,
so,
Yeah. And let's distinguish inflation. There's inflation caused by government, and there's inflation caused by the market. So this is market inflation.
Right.
This is an increase in government inflation, which is spending, borrowing, printing money, and then which causes prices to go up. And then, of course, people want their wages to go up to meet the increasing prices. And that's what I would call market inflation. I don't know if anybody else makes that distinction, but I think we should. Makes sense to you? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. You know, I mean, I think that that definitely holds true. You know, I mean, it's you know, I mean, the government inflation, you know, I mean, is them just incessantly spending and printing money. You know, I mean, it's obviously it's you know, if you're going to do that, you're going to cause problems. You know, additionally, now you have fuel costs, right? You know, I mean, fuel costs. The oil hit a new high, so it hasn't hit the pump yet, but it's coming.
The effect is the same, though, whether it's market inflation. In other words, unions want more money and people want more money in general for wages. And then the companies have to pay more, which means they have to charge more to cover their labor costs. It doesn't matter whether it's market-based inflation or whether it's government-based inflation. The result is the same. Prices go up, and that's not good.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The public pays, is what it is, you know. So, you know, last night you were saying inflation was up. Okay, it did. So I went and pulled stuff. You know, I don't know that it spiked, you know, but inflation for the month was up 0.3%.
But it's not
still
down.
Hovering.
Yeah.
No, it's not down. You know, and that the reason it gone up specifically, food costs have gone sideways. You know, so they've stabilized. Housing costs have gone sideways. They have stabilized in some markets.
Okay.
Actually, they've gone back up. There is a rise in fuel costs, which is part of the mix. Consumer spending was a little higher than anticipated. So, producer price index, I think, was up. So, you know, was it up enough that the market didn't like that news? No. I think the market is really waiting on what the Fed does on the 20th.
Yeah, there's two big dates coming up, the 20th and then the 30th when the government runs out of money. So there's a bunch of stuff going on. Let's get the report in now, and then we can talk about it. Otherwise, we'll just be speculating on numbers, and I think I'd rather have the picture first. What do you think?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly fine. Yeah, the computer was going a little slow, so I was trying to get it done while it was here.
Or just make it up then. the government.
No.
Why shouldn't you?
I mean, I've tried to do it before. You know what I mean? Because I couldn't get it to come up, but I got it here. If you're ready. Well, good morning, everybody. This is Derek with the Action Radio Financial Report. Stocks finished firmly higher, and they closed higher on Thursday as the market digested retail sales data that exceeded expectation and a mixed producer price index inflation report. Leadership was broad, with both cyclical and defensive stock sectors performing well. Overseas Asian markets finished higher ahead of China's Friday economic activity report. European markets also closed higher following the European Central Bank's ECB decision to raise rates by 25 basis points to 4%. European markets had a positive response to the commentary from the ECB Council, stating it believes that current interest rates are in restrictive territory, which could signal a pause for future rate hikes. Oil continued its march higher, finishing around $90 a barrel, while their treasury yields – oh, my goodness. Sorry, it's sliding and moving on me.
That's okay. We'll wait. We'll vamp. Page two.
Oh, no, it like moved all the way to the bottom of it. Sorry.
I get reports all the time. I'll be reading an article on the air, and an ad will pop in the middle of it, or it'll keep shifting on me. You know, because they're trying to maximize their advertising stuff. It's hysterical. So don't worry about it. It's just, believe me, I understand. Yeah. We just work around all this stuff. Yeah.
Had to pause. So oil finished higher around $90 a barrel, while the treasury yield rose across the curve with both the 10-year and 2-year higher on the day. All right, now you can do your page two.
And now page two.
Today, U.S. equities closed higher with the Dow Jones up 332 points or 0.96 to 34,908. The NASDAQ closed up 112 points or 0.81 to 13,926. And the S&P 500 closed up 38 points or 0.84 to 45,05. In the bond market, the 10-year Treasury yields are trading at 4.29%. higher by 0.03. In the commodity markets, the price of crude oil was up $1.83 or 2% to $90.35, and the spot price of gold was down $2.30 or 0.12 to $19.30.20. This is Derek with the Action Radio Financial Report. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
All right. You know, it's interesting. For those who don't know, the reason I say, and now, page two, with Paul Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit for Derek's time, but Paul Harvey was on for years, you know, like 40 or 50 years on the radio. And he literally was reading from pages. You know, there were no computers when he started radio. So I think somehow he probably goofed on a page turn, you know, probably in the 1930s or 40s or whenever he got started, right? And then he literally said, and now, page two? And then it became part of his routine. So that's where all that came from. So there is generally a basis for a lot of the things that I talk about here. So a friend was concerned about the real estate market. Do you have any news on that?
Yeah, I mean, so the real estate market as a whole, you know, I do. I mean, and I could talk a little bit about, you know, the area specific, you know what I mean? So, you know, the real estate market, you know what I mean, like the comment that was used was crash. I don't necessarily see a crash, and I'll tell you why. And this I will tell you partially facts-based as well. So you have to understand that demand for housing right now is still extraordinarily high. Right. Okay. So the demand would have to be curbed. The only thing that would cause any real estate market to have a significant correction would be the rental market. And
how does that
you know,
work?
There are so the rental market is what happens is like people start moving out of the area because they're moving to other areas where the rent is not so high, you know, which will force, you know, if nobody's occupying because of the high prices, it will force them to lower prices to attract new people, right? So, you know, there are certain markets, and we're experiencing a little bit of that pressure even in our area. You know, and I saw some reports that said, you know, the rental market has increased significantly, and they actually blame like Vrbo and Airbnb because these people, you know, just buy properties, convert it to a rental and do these short-term rentals and just let it sit and charge these astronomical prices that it would be for these daily rates rather than, you know, allowing somebody to live there for long periods of time, you know, cause so they can make the extra money, you know? So is that true in our market? You know, if you get down to the beach, I would say yes. You know, I mean, if you're up, you know, in the north side of town, I would say, you know, it's going to minimize.
So they're buying houses specifically to make them Airbnb, you know, hotels, basically?
Absolutely, yeah. I saw a thing in Maui where something like 30% of the island's homes are Airbnb or Vrbo.
I'm not familiar with Vrbo. Is it the same kind of thing?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Vrbo. I haven't heard Vrbo before. Is it
Vrbo.
Kind of
Vrbo's Airbnb's competition.
Oh, okay, like DoorDash and Grubhub kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's okay. The same thing. You know, okay. I mean, there might be benefits to each. You know, I don't know that specifically, but, you know, the bottom line is they it's a rental site.
Yeah, yeah. Don't they have, like, a homestead tax or something they have to pay if they have short-term rentals? Or is that a different
thing? I don't know the answer to that, to be honest. You know, I do know that, like, your homeowner's insurance is different if you're renting it.
Huh. Well, that makes sense. Okay. I mean, I'm just curious.
Yeah.
You know, like real estate is not something I know a whole lot about, but like I say, I had people, and I know a lot of there's a ton of real estate agents in this area. But here's a different question. Are we building too many houses possibly for the demand? And that might lower the price of housing a bit because we have housing developments going up all over our area, probably all over Florida. Just everybody seems to
I would
move
say,
here in Texas.
Yeah, considering our area, the answer would be no. You know, I know our area is under pressure, you know, and I mean, and, you know, a lot of people are complaining, you know, even near where I live, man, I mean, they're building like 700 houses, you know, so yeah,
we don't have the infrastructure.
It's a lot, you know,
we don't have the infrastructure.
you actually just beat me to it. You know, my concern you can build all these houses, you know what I mean? But, you know, have the taxes, you know, either increased or have the taxes compensated, you know, for the schools, for the roads, you know, for the increase of those type of people. You know, I mean, like, you know, your grocery stores for the most part can handle, you know, influx in population up to a certain point. You know, I mean, you've got certain areas that it's grown so fast they can't keep up with it, right? They're going to have to build more grocery stores. But we're expanding in that area enough. Where we're not expanding enough is like the roads and the schools, you know,
right.
In our area, you know, I mean, those, I mean, you know, all the high schools are overcrowded already. You know, I mean, you know, I moved here in 2015, you know, one of them in the area, and I'm not going to throw them under the bus, but one of them in the area was almost at capacity. The other one was okay. You know, out of the two. You know, so, you know, where they're at now, I mean, you know, I ran into the same thing when I went to school in Central Florida. I mean, they had those little portables and stuff because they couldn't build a school fast enough.
I saw them in California. Yeah, they had that stuff too.
Yeah.
But I just read a report. This is kind of fun. We're all over the place today. This is good. But I just was reading a report in our local Santa Rosa News and I think Studio 850, another news source. So these are local sources around here, folks, that they were talking about school enrollment is down. And it's not because there aren't enough kids, but the parents are choosing to, you know, use vouchers, homeschool, private school, things like that. So there's two things going on. People are moving in, but the schools may not have the same amount of pressure because fewer parents are sending their kids to government schools, which I find quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, with the rise in concerns over what's being taught to your children, I think the government schools are going to be under pressure.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, it's I just saw one of these videos in a school in California where the child had finally complained after months that the teacher was teaching, you know, the LGBTQ stuff 3 days out of the week, you know, to the kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what the mother did was went around and, like, pulled other mothers and kids and got them to probe, and they found out this. And the school, she reported it, the school board did absolutely nothing. She said, here's your standardized test, and this class is significantly behind where everybody else is because this stuff is being pushed, and you guys are allowing this to happen. You know what I mean? And it's like, why are we not teaching our kids the math, science, English, so on and so forth? You know, we're teaching them this stuff, which is not going to benefit them in life other than, you know, how it influences their development. And, you know, it's just, I can't believe that we've gotten to this point. I can't believe that we allow that type of stuff.
Oh,
you know,
I can.
The best
thing that ever happened with COVID, and there's very little. I mean, you know, other than the virus itself wasn't as serious as we all thought. But the best thing that happened was that parents were able to see what the kids were doing. As soon as they went home, they did online learning. And it's like, you're teaching my kid what? you know, that was absolutely fabulous. But few people, people are now, you know, kind of getting to my recommendation was. As soon as the schools closed back in 2020, I said, this is a golden opportunity. I said, we have a window now. We have to exercise this. We need to close the government schools. We need to sell the buildings to private schools. We need to cancel all the taxes related to education. We need to move to a full private school situation right now. I said, now is the time to do it. The teachers are all on, you know, they're all on beaches in Sao Paulo, Brazil. You know, they're all taking their money because they're still getting paid, right? But so they were all on vacation. They're on the beaches in Jamaica. You know, I said, now's the time. Close the schools, fire the teachers, and have them rehired in a private system. And everybody thought I was nuts. It's like, no, I tell you. Of course, now I don't look so nuts. But that was the time to do it.
Well, you know, I mean, then the education system would turn into like the prison system. You know what I mean? Like where you know, once they went private, it turned into this giant money scam.
Oh, well, I'm sure that's what's going to happen. I got Bianchi on the line. I want to take you just a second, but I want to get back to the main issue of unions and the fact that the pilots union, that's one thing. They're not as big, but the auto workers, that's a huge union. And getting basically a 50% pay raise over 4 years. Let's you know what's that? That's over 10%. That's about 12.5% per year. Let's just say 12% a year. So inflation.
Well, they're
going to is what 4 or 5%
the moon. You know, and hope for the best. But you know, do I think that they'll get that? No, I think that's a bit ridiculous. You know, but, you know, could they get something like, you know, hey, 20%, 30%? Yeah, I mean, that's in the realm of feasible.
Okay. So if inflation, let's just pick an average, the next, you know, few years, 5%, it's probably more than that, but let's just say if it's 5% and they're getting a 10% raise per year, they're basically doubling, you know, they've exceeded the inflation rate by 5%. So it's actually a net gain, which is not a bad thing. I understand why they're doing it. And I advocate for more wages too. But that's good overall the whole economy. What about the other unions? What if the teams start doing that? All the truck drivers.
Well, I mean, you're going to have to understand that people, other unions are probably going to follow suit.
Yeah. And how about the government unions, SEIU and the teachers? They're going, well, if you're paying the auto workers more, we want a 50% pay raise too. Not that they need it, you know, because of all the pensions, benefits, and things like that. And the fact they work 190 days of the year. But they're going to ask for it too. This is going to be a huge effect economically. Yeah. Just curious.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You know, there's already talk for the politicians. There's already talk about them. You know, the Republicans are like, okay, listen, we would rather take a pay cut and have better facilities and stipends in D.C. because we have to go back to our states and districts than you know, higher pay where we have to figure it out ourselves. And I'm like, okay, I agree with that. That makes sense. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They have to combat with D.C. You know, maybe they build a government hotel or something like that, right? You know, where each person has their own room or something. That would be ideal in the long term, right? You know, I mean, I'm just making something up. I'm not sure that's the answer. I'm just, there's I think it was Matt Gaetz that was talking about that. You know, I know nobody likes that guy, but, you know, he was just like, listen.
Oh, I don't mind him. I just want him on the show.
You know, I think it was him. Don't quote me on it. But, you know, he's basically saying, listen, you know, we are overpaid for what we do. You know, and he says there's no way we could continue to justify these kind of costs at the American taxpayer. You know, and I'm just like, oh, my God, bravo to you, sir. You know, it's just like you work half the year and you make $250,000 a year. You know what I mean? It's just like, really? Sign me up for that job.
Yeah, sounds good to me too. Yeah, I mean, and any national companies that want to sponsor Action Radio and bring us to a level where I can pay everybody for this, but I'm more than happy. You know, would not be a problem.
Right.
Let's get Bianchi, and then I'll ask about the budget. We're going to get that in a bit. Bianchi, what's your question? Good morning, sir.
Well, I think that good morning, Derek.
Yeah, morning.
We know that fiscal year ends this month, and if they go over the fiscal year in spending, then what should happen is that they lower the budget by 10%, 15%.
They want a continuing resolution. They want a clean one, which means they want a dirty one. They want all the same spending. They just want to continue spending at these levels and keep increasing. Well, they've already, got $2 trillion extra this year? You get the forecast another $2 trillion above the revenue next year? Derek, what's going on with that?
Revenues at $4.5 trillion, I think it is, revenue per year. And, you know, they're talking about spending $6.5 trillion?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, that's
insane.
Well,
that's not going to fly.
That shouldn't happen.
No, I mean your cap each year should be $3 trillion. You know what I mean? So you're paying your debts and making your spending. As an example, you know, I mean, like it's and really, you know, I mean the what was the $3 trillion spending bill that Biden had originally that got right. whittled down to two, you know, or 1.8, whatever it was, something like 60% of it was going to governmental programs and not infrastructure. What was it, the infrastructure bill or whatever? Build Back Better or whatever the heck it was called?
No, build the Democrat Party Back Better is what it was. That's all it was.
Well, no, build their pockets back better. You know, where's the accountability department? That's what I want to see. You know what I mean? Where, when we spend money, I want to see exactly where it's going. I want to see receipts.
Well, it's supposed to be done by Congress in their budget. You got a House Ways and Means and Appropriations Committees, and the Senate has the same thing. I think they have budget and ways.
But
they're supposed to.
You know what I mean?
No,
they're
a terrible
there's
job.
Already questions about they sent right. the $80 billion over to Ukraine, and they don't have receipts for that. You know, so everybody's
that?
Like, okay, where did the money go? Show us exactly where this money went. And, you know, I mean, it's fallen on deaf ears, right? Nobody wants to look at that stuff. And for me, you know, when you're spending the taxpayers' dollars, man, like, show me. You know what I mean? You need to show me this crap.
Yeah. Yeah, there's really two things that Congress does. It's budgeting, which needs to be accounted for, and defense spending, which needs to be accounted for. I mean, they have to spend on defense because they have to defend the nation. I mean, that's a given. That's what most – in fact, Walter Williams and I talked about this when he was still around, obviously. But, you know, he said, you know, basically two-thirds of the federal budget should be national defense and about, you know, another 20% for infrastructure, roads, things like that. And then, like, you know, 5% for everything else, you know, all the necessary offices of government, Supreme Court, patent office, things like that. But most of the federal government budget should be on defense. And the fact that it's not, it's on entitlements, which were never in the Constitution. You know, that's a huge thing. So sooner or later, they're going to have to privatize, you know, and make independent retirement accounts of Social Security and health choice for Medicare. That's just going to have to happen. But the question in the short term, you know, they don't budget like they used to. They don't do appropriations. They used to spend all year on hearings, on budget hearings. That's all they did. There are people in Congress, that's all they did was do appropriations. And they would have hearings all year long just to set the budgets. And everybody would come in and testify. And they don't do any of that anymore. They just do continuing resolutions. It's really terrible.
Right. I believe it is, but, you know, hey, the times we live in aren't necessarily that great.
No, but they are interesting. So let me ask you both a question. Hey. Pianki, just to fill you in case you missed the beginning, we were talking about inflation. And I like to make the distinction between government inflation, which is the borrowing of money that they don't have, raising the debt ceiling, printing money, which results in increasing money supply, which results in what I call government inflation. And then there's the inflation that gets compounded on top of that, which is market inflation. As the prices go up because of government inflation, people want more wages. They want all kinds of different things, benefits, everything else. And because of that, companies have to charge more for that. And it's reflected in higher prices. And so the prices go up. So the market inflation comes on top of the government inflation. So it's almost like a double inflation, and things get really bad. But the solution, I believe, the simple one, rather than 10% or, you know, I mean, we all have a solution. Mine's very simple. Congress stops borrowing money. If Congress stops borrowing money, all this nonsense stops. There won't be inflation. The debt will be paid off. We will have an increasing price. There will be deflation. The prices will come down. So it's just staggering to me how simple the solution is and how resistant everybody is to this incredibly simple solution. Gentlemen?
You know what the Speaker of the House said about that?
No, I don't. Tell me.
Speaker of the House, he made a comment on two things. He said term limits and balanced budget, I think he said, is going to have to be done by Congress. Is never going to do that on their own.
No, we have to do it.
No.
No, this is why I said the states have to do it, but I don't want – did you hear my report yesterday, my interview with Mark Meckler, Convention of States? I put that recording on from the podcast I did several years ago. Pianki, did you hear that?
Yeah, I think we had a problem with the I had problems, or somebody had problems with the audio.
Oh, well, check it out. It should have been on yesterday's show. But anyway, the point is that the states, Congress is not going to do it. So you're not going to get two-thirds of the Congress to vote for a constitutional amendment to stop them borrowing money. The states, but I don't want a convention of states either. So my plan, the states do it by resolution. They say, we will pass this amendment. and then start withholding money from the federal government until they pass it. I mean, they're going to have to force it, just like the feds forced the raising of the drinking age by withholding highway funds. So there's definitely precedent for this. So the states do that.
Right.
They get this into Congress. Congress passes it by 2/3. Then those states who passed it by resolution can pass it, actually, you know, ratify the amendment that Congress can no longer borrow money. Then everything changes. I mean, that's the plan.
I hear what you say, but I'm for a convention of states because Congress is not going to do it. You still got to get a congressperson to take it in.
But my plan is you don't need a convention. You don't need a convention of states if the states do it by resolution, which is not binding, but it certainly tells how they feel about it. And then they can start withholding money from the feds as incentive, shall we say. Let's get Derek's view. He's going to have to go in a minute or two. And I got Chadwick Moore coming back, the author of Tucker. So that's going to be kind of cool. Derek, what do you think? As opposed to either convention or just the economy, just the economics effect in general of just Congress stopping to borrow money, which I think would be incredible.
I agree with it 100%. I think the first part, I think we would do much better by everybody if we focus on the term limits first.
Okay.
Yeah, and obviously if you focus on term limits, you know, there's not going to be an incentive for people to be these lifer, politicians, which mean you might change the quality of what goes in there. You know what I mean? Like people that are really trying to make things that are going to be impactful rather than make a career and set up some kind of big old power base.
If you did term limits, I think you'd have to change the how people are nominated for office because we don't get to choose our candidates. We get to choose the candidates that the Democrats and the Republicans give to us. And they're going to give deep state candidates. So I'm not for term limits right now because I don't think it's going to change enough. And I think it'd be a lot of fuss over nothing. Just like the balanced budget amendment as written has an escape clause. It's got an emergency or a public health or it's got enough ways to get out of it. You'll never get a budget without debt. You'll never get one because if you declare an emergency, it'll be gone. Okay, there's Chadwick. So we're going to kind of wrap this up now. But I'll let Chadwick listen to this debate. This might be kind of interesting. So let's get final comments from Pianki and Derek. Pianki, why don't you go first?
Article 5 that's being proposed is not only asking for term limits for elected officials, but also federal officials, period.
Yeah.
It's staying in what you want.
Well, I'd love to see nobody should be in
government
longer than 10 years.
That's why Tommy has to be. Yeah, okay. And you got over 200,000. You got over 200,000 bureaucrats, and many of them, if not probably about 80% of them, is there because of their recommendation by some congressperson.
Yeah.
So that's why you can't rely on Congress to do it. You're going to have states and states using Article 5.
All right. So yeah, let's hold up on that. And Derek, let's get your last comment, and then I want to get to Chadwick.
No, I don't have anything, Greg. I mean, this is it's been very interesting. We'll let you get on. And you guys have yourself a nice week, and I'll see you next week.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Derek. Yeah. All right, let's bring Chadwick in the middle of our conversation here, which is kind of fun, which is what we do a lot of times anyway. So just to let folks know, Chadwick Moore is the author of Tucker, Biography of Tucker Carlson. And so you just walked into a huge discussion. We're discussing my constitutional amendment to take away the power of Congress to borrow money. What do you think?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me back on. I missed most of the conversation. So Congress be limited on borrowing money? Well, I think absolutely any sane person would agree with that.
Okay. Well, this just let you know, we are unique in the world in the fact that we actually write, propose, and advocate legislation. And one of the biggest bills that we have currently right now, and I think it's more important than ever, especially as they're trying for another continuing resolution in Congress to keep funding, about $2 trillion above the money they take in, is a constitutional amendment, which basically takes away the phrase that says to borrow money on the credit of the United States. So we delete that phrase so that Congress cannot borrow money on the credit of the United States. Maybe they can borrow from China or somewhere else. I don't care. But they can't borrow it on us. And so what this would do is if they can't borrow money, that would freeze the national debt. The debt would not increase. And as the Treasury bills and Treasury notes come due, they would be paid off just like they always are. But they couldn't be rolled over. And so they would gradually reduce the national debt, which would reduce the interest on the national debt. Well, what that means is as things go down, the value of the dollar, you know, is going to increase because they won't be printing money and flooding the market with more dollars. So the currency would stabilize. Dollar goes up in value, which means the prices drop because the dollar can buy more. The purchasing power increases, which means everybody's retirement accounts, savings, everything else, personal wealth goes up. And there's a massive transfer, hopefully through deflation, 5, 10%, whatever, from the government, from the central banks, from the Fed, back to people because of the increase in the value of the dollar, as opposed to our purchasing power being transferred to government because of the decrease in the value of the dollar. So that's why it's such a key amendment. I know you kind of walked in on it partially. I didn't know how much you'd heard, but that's one of our big issues.
Well, of course, our lawmakers have no incentive to do that because government produces absolutely nothing that nobody wants or needs, so they can print as much money as they want, and they don't care. And of course, inflation is, it's the frog in the boiling pot. So as long as our government keeps printing money and sending it to places like Ukraine or God knows what else they're doing with it, it all seems fine and a little unnerving until suddenly it isn't, and you're going to the grocery store with, you know, stacks and stacks of money to buy a loaf of bread or whatever. But of course, the government's not incentivized to do that. I mean, I think it takes a much larger change in culture to get rid of, to fix the situation that we're in now. I don't think people really understand how quickly things can devolve. I was just thinking of Tucker. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone saw his latest interview with the man who's running for president of Argentina, and they were talking about extensively about inflation and what's happening in Argentina. And Tucker in Argentina, Tucker goes and exchanges $100 bill for Argentinian pesos, and he's got this, you know, 6-inch stack of money from, you know, from 100 U.S. dollars.
Really?
And, you know, I think looking at Argentina might be it's a really great interview. People can check it out on X if they're interested. And it's really interesting to look at what happened to Argentina. You have what was formerly the wealthiest country on the continent, formerly a beautiful continent country, and to see how what happened with the currency there, what happened with inflation there, and more interestingly, how it so mirrors what's happening here. I mean, you have the president of Argentina, or a guy who's running for president of Argentina, talking about social justice and trans ideology and the Ministry of Women that was set up there.
What a surprise.
And you think, well, I thought this was just an American thing, but no, it has happened all over the world, and it's happening here now.
Well, I have not caught that latest episode. I try to keep up with my Tucker ones. The one I found fascinating was Larry Sinclair, the person who, engaged with Barack Obama, you know, in the back of a limo with cocaine. That was incredible. That was an amazing interview. But I want to focus on what you're talking about here because this is interesting. Argentina, Brazil, and Venezuela. Let's take them all as case studies. Each one of them had incredible wealth, incredible prosperity, and incredible freedom. Those two go together. You can't have freedom without wealth and personal property, and you can't have personal property and wealth without freedom. So the one thing that the globalist World Economic Forum, deep state, you know, communist movement does is they usually steal an election, install a socialist, globalist, you know, leftist ideologue. They destroy the currency, they destroy the country, and people leave. And they think that's somehow a good thing. But, you know, they come preaching in, it's going to be great. We'll have social justice. We'll have equity. You know, your life will be fine. You won't have to work. There'll be a guaranteed income. Of course, it's a bunch of nonsense. But if you notice the three countries, Venezuela, Argentina, and Brazil, they all had, you know, basically conservative presidents. They all had their offices stolen, and they all had this massive push of socialism and communism.
Yeah, and even with the case of Venezuela, they want people to leave because they can't support their own population on the welfare state. So they're happy to send all the refugees here in the United States, make them our problem. They want fewer people. I mean, once these socialist governments are installed, fewer people is one of the big goals. Fewer people is like the biggest goal of the left right now. It's what climate change is about. It's what abortion is about. It's about fewer people on Earth. And of course, they realize that their socialist government's going to have fewer people in order to sustain themselves. Well, not that they won't ever be able to sustain themselves. That's what they believe.
No, there'll never be fewer enough people because they still want the work done. Someone's got to do it. Well, this is an interesting question. So here's the leftist dichotomy. I want to get to your book, if I get too sidetracked, just let me know. But it's interesting that the left is bringing in 15 million illegal aliens, increasing our carbon footprint and increasing everything else here and COVID exposure and you name it, while at the same time, basically reducing Americans. So I've made this is going to be kind of my bold claim is that it's abortion and COVID shots for Americans, and it's free hotels and a pass illegal aliens. So who's really being replaced? It's the Americans who love freedom that are being replaced. Yeah.
Well, exactly. Well, in this country, it's more about first destabilizing the entire country and tearing it apart and burning it to the ground in order to rebuild the socialist utopia. And, of course, there's a huge way to do it. Open the borders, bring in the third world, totally decimate your cities and your native population, demoralize them. That's far more important. Mm-hmm. Have people feel, you know, no sense of community and no sense of togetherness because no one speaks the same language. Everyone's disoriented. Nobody has common cultural touchstones. So you disorient the population. You tear it down in that way, and then you completely break the system, bring it to the ground, and then you can rebuild your socialist utopia, and then start getting rid of people that you can't afford.
Yeah, then you kill millions of people, and the gulags strike come up, and the and then the killing fields and the whole bit. We know the story. So what can you as a writer do about it? As an individual, where do you see your place in fixing this? I know my place. I'm a citizen legislator creating Action Radio. What's your place? What are your goals as a writer?
Well, you know, I think that I work more on the cultural end of the hearts and minds and the storytelling. You know, I think that with something with Tucker Carlson, you know, I think he's probably the most influential, important voice in American politics and certainly in media. And with this book, you know, he's someone who's so portrayed in this two-dimensional way as, you know, this comic book villain and someone not to be taken seriously, a conspiracy theorist, et cetera. But he's not, you know, he's a human being. And with this book, you know, I think we really humanized him, told his story where he, and really hashed out what he believes, where, why he believes it, where he came from. And I think that so much of it is it has to do with changing hearts and minds. I mean, I think that you have to fight every day on that respect. What you're doing is important work, obviously, but, you know, looking at the law and how that can be changed to make things better. You also have to, you know, change people's minds about what their preconceptions are in the culture and figures who are important. So I think every day you have to fight on those cultural lines and punch back at the lies that the regime and their media tell and the way that they have tried to win people over. I mean, the left has this perception of dominating the culture and winning through that respect, whether it's literature and books, you know, obviously, you know, Hollywood, entertainment, music, fashion, et cetera. But that's not so entirely true. There are conservatives operating in that sphere all the time. They just don't get the recognition. And they constantly have their work, you know, stifled or suppressed.
Interesting. This is probably a question that takes three or four chapters of your book. But what is it about Tucker that set him on this course of being this independent, of going to Twitter, of being fired by Fox, and instead of, you know, retiring and going into writing and public speaking and all the things that people do, spending more time with their family, he actually is changing journalism, changing newscasting. You know, why him? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's probably twofold. I think firstly, it's his personality. He's someone who never wants to be told what to do or what to say. Never
oh,
wants
I know that
to
feeling.
Shut up. If someone, you know, and, you know, a lot of us do. If you say you can't say that or do that, it's more incentive to do it. And he embodies that, you know, more than you know, so many people I've ever met. I think, and that, you know, in turn comes from his father. It comes from his upbringing. It comes from all sorts of things in his youth and childhood that I found in writing this book. And then I think secondly, you know, I think he is genuinely, you know, I could say something like, you know, he really cares about this country and wants to save it. And that's all true. But I think a lot of it comes from, he spent his entire life, adult life in Washington, D.C. until recently around these people. And I think he's genuinely angry and incensed at the hypocrisy and the corruption that he's known his entire life, that how these people are constantly screwing over the country. You know, as we said earlier, you know, these are people who make nothing, contribute absolutely nothing, and they steal from the rest of us. And I think that he's seen enough of it that it enrages him and he wants to expose it. And he is, you know, kind of like Donald Trump. He's a perfect vessel for this in the sense that he comes from that world and he can call it out as an insider. He's a class traitor in so many respects.
Interesting. I wrote an article you might be interested in, too. At my here's my shameless plug, gregpenglis.substack.com, called The Nation of Government. And it described Washington, D.C. as its own country. They have their own passports. They have their own credentials. They have their own, you know, tax system. They use the states like colonies to give them revenue. They think they have unlimited power. They defy the Constitution. They become a self-reinforcing, self-propagandizing, you know, separate entity. I mean, Washington really is like a country, you know, with 50 colonies around it. It's a scary thing, but I think, I really think they believe that we are here to serve them and to increase their power. so they can rule over us. When they talk about the rule of law, and I hate the expression because it's not the rule of law. It's we the people give our consent to be governed, and they've lost that. They actually think that they rule with the law, which is why I set about on a course to change the laws. But if you look at it, I bet you find that interesting. But just that whole philosophy, do you see Washington as I see Washington, as an independent country with its own borders, passports, you know, like I say, credentials? It's they're really a separate world.
Oh, for sure. If you were to describe Washington, D.C. in just plain terms, or even specifically the Biden administration, everything they've done, if you were just to describe this to someone and not say what you're talking about, and you would, they would think you were talking about some tiny country in Africa that you've never heard of. Oh, well, of course that's a corrupt government. Oh, that sounds like some corrupt third world nation. Yeah, no, it's actually Washington, D.C. That's how the capital works. But nobody who lives there notices that, I don't think, because it seems so normal to them. It's like when you look at Washington media and why they – a lot of times – you know, I'm thinking about the interview that Tucker did with Devin Archer, where Devin's just sort of very – plainly describing the level of corruption that in, you know, with Hunter Biden and with the regulators and the Biden administration and how the influence works. And he and Tucker are talking about it like they're discussing a football game. I mean, it's just totally normal. I mean, Tucker's obviously in on it. He knows what he's getting out of him. But I think that's why Washington, and not just to single the Biden administration as much as they deserve it. I think that's every administration or almost every administration or every lawmaker. But exposing that's exactly how Washington works was so shocking to average Americans, because we think we know it, to hear it so plainly. But it's not shocking to Washington press, because that's just of course this is what happens. They understand this. So why would they report on this as newsworthy? Of course someone's selling influence. Like, what else do you do? Why else do you run for office? That makes it even more horrifying, I think. Washington is probably the most cloistered place in the entire country.
Oh, I've been there. I interned there. That's where a lot of what I learned about school from college was actually – I learned more in 3 months interning in Washington than I did at 4 years at my liberal university of Massachusetts. And then when I went to Europe – oh, yeah, it's amazing. And then I went to Europe after college, and I crossed the Berlin Wall, and I spent a day in communist East Berlin. And that was the other half of my education. So between Washington and East Berlin, liberalism went out the window really quickly. Well, here's a question. Would Tucker ever openly either challenge the election, as I do on a daily basis? I say point blank, the election was stolen in 2020. We are the victim of a coup d'etat, you know, exactly like Niger and Gabon and all these other countries. Of course, they're military takeovers. But there's no difference between a takeover, an overthrow of a government in all these other countries, and an overthrow of the government here. Would Tucker, do you think, ever want to – let's say Joe Biden. Here's my dream scenario. Tucker says, hey, Mr. President, which he's not, Mr. President, come on the show. I really want to talk about your accomplishments and things like that. And then Tucker gets Joe Biden on the air and says, so why did you steal the election in 2020? I mean, just to ask it just like that, wouldn't that be fabulous? This is my dream.
That would be fabulous. that'd be absolutely fabulous. I'm sure you'd probably be more likely to get some Democrats on Tucker's show than you would some Republicans, to be honest. So I think Tucker is probably best at holding Republicans' feet to the fire and calling them out for their misdeeds, which they really don't like. And to be reminded, it was the right, or the supposed political right, that got him fired, that pulled him off the air. It wasn't the left that had been trying to for so long unsuccessfully. It came from within the House. So it would be wonderful to see him do that, for sure.
Okay. Well, you know, I always have ideas for him too. And so I'm hoping to, and also if you ever want to report on anything that we're doing, any of our bills, anything like that, please feel free. I would be more than happy to talk to you, about all the things we've got going, especially like our constitutional amendments. But I still think it'd be a cool thing somehow to see Donald Trump and Robert Kennedy sit down somehow together, because you look at the campaign now, you've got the traditional campaign, you got the Democrat, you got the Republican goobers, which is short for globalist deep staters. So you got the goobers are going to debate again on the 27th, and they're going to say nothing because I don't think Trump will be there. You got Robert Kennedy, who's already been denied any kind of debate possibility with Brandon, and so you've got these two incredible figures out there. I might have missed it. Has Tucker interviewed Robert Kennedy separately? Have they had a chat?
Yeah, more than once. He did, on Twitter in his recent iteration, they did a long sit-down with Robert Kennedy. Kennedy announced his presidency on Tucker's show as well, on his Fox show.
Okay, so I got to catch up on that. Thank you. So I need to review. He's busy running a show. But has he ever thought of getting those two together, which I think would be just an incredible, a Donald Trump Kennedy, just a group discussion would be unbelievable. I've talked to a lot of people about it. They think it would be fabulous.
Oh, yeah, it'd be totally interesting. Yeah, I mean, that'd be a wonderful thing. I don't know if they would both do it, but, I mean, to see those two interact would be pretty amazing for sure.
Yeah. Where is Tucker going to take journalism? I may have asked this a little bit before, but I'm just trying to think because I have this vision also of conservative news advocates. So in other words, somebody the left has already left the world of journalism. There is no objective reporting. They're basically propaganda. So this is the way the world is, especially when it comes to impeachment. I should ask you about the memo. Let me get to that in just a second. But you've got a world now where you've got liberal journalists who are basically propagandists and activists. And you've got conservative journalists who are trying to be objective. In fact, I've contacted One American News and Newsmax. I said, guys, you know, this objective journalism, this fantasy that you're living in is over. It's been over for 20 years. I said, you need to start advocating solutions. And so I came up with the term conservative news advocate. I see Tucker as not quite there, but he's kind of heading there. In his interviews, he doesn't like offer direct solutions, but he's sort of really outlining the problems, and the people that he's talking to are kind of getting towards the solutions. At least he's saying this isn't good enough. Where we are now is not working. So do you think he'd ever either break that whatever line it is to becoming an advocate, you know, beyond just a journalist, like the left has broken, you know, objective journalism and just become outright propagandists? What do you think?
Well, I think that he, I don't know, I think that dances along a line that, you know, Tucker sees himself as a professional observer, and I think he's really happy with his station in life. I think that's where he sees it, where okay. He belongs. So, you know, he sees himself as somebody who observes and makes connections and puts things together to tell a story. You know, he's not someone, people often speculate if he'd run for office. I don't think he ever would. I mean, I've been wrong about things before, but, you know, because I don't think that he really has that. I mean, he said he wouldn't, but I don't think he would because I don't think he firstly has that gene that where he thinks he can lead. You know, I don't think that he believes that he deserves to lead people or tell them how to live. But
yeah, no, I think you're onto something. He does lead, though.
Yeah, but
he
does. Yeah, but I don't think he, you know, he would never. I don't think he'd ever run for office for that. And then also, he would just never want to put his family at that level of scrutiny. That's for sure. But I don't know. I think he doesn't really see himself that way.
Well, I've thought of that too. People have asked me all the time, why don't you run for office? I said, why would I be a voice? Why would I be one in 435 members of Congress when I can be the world's only citizen legislator action radio host? Why would I give up the unique position I have now to be a voice and be responsible to a party? Why would I want the Republican Party telling me how to vote or giving me my campaign funds or have donors? Because I'm not rich. I'm not a billionaire. Why would I subject myself to having to grub for money, you know, from people that don't like what I do anyway? And I bet you Tucker, on a larger scale, is probably thinking those same kind of things. Why would he subject himself to running for office and having other people tell him what to do? He's already had that his whole life. Now he's in a position where nobody tells him what to do. I think he's probably excited about what's happening. What do you think?
I agree, and I also think that we shouldn't hold politicians on such a pedestal that if you are influential, making a difference in the world, well, you have to run for office. Screw Washington. Screw those people. Some people are much better and have much better impact doing exactly what they're doing in the world of communicating or in journalism or in getting the message out there or, you know, putting changing the culture of ideas in this country and injecting ideas and information in this country than, you know, being some member of Congress.
Yeah, or actually writing the laws that get our freedom back, which is what we do here.
Right, exactly.
But no one's – but, well, let me ask
which
you –
which no one in Congress
is
doing it, appears.
Yeah, well, this is kind of maybe a selfish question on my part, but there's a resistance to reporting on us. I'm not talking about you specifically. I'm just, and I don't want you to feel like this is my personal question, but I'm talking about Newsmax, One American News, Fox, when they were actually reporting conservative things, independent writers, journalists. I've contacted, I can't tell you how many people. Nobody wants to report on what we're doing here. I find this fascinating in of itself. I call it raising complaining to an art form. They're all happy with complaining. And but they don't, you know, but we represent real change here, serious change. And yet the world of conservative journalism wants nothing to do with us. Do you have any insights for me? Can I help me out here?
I think my only insights might be, you know, media in general, publishing, any of that stuff is, and it took me over 20 years to realize this. I take that back. I realized it immediately day one when I was 21 years old and moved to New York City trying to get a job in media.
Right.
that an impenetrable world. It's a world that looks after its own and takes care of itself. And if people don't know you, then they don't want anything to do with you. And it's, you know, it's like, it's a club that you got to be in. And, you know, I especially saw it when I worked in liberal media, like way more than conservative media, like for sure.
Huh.
But I still think that I think all media has this kind of high school mentality. It's one of the reasons why personally, I don't have many friends in media. I don't hang out with a lot of other journalists. All my close friends that I'm close to is nowhere in this world because it is kind of like a high school mentality. I get invited to like some like, you know, media parties and stuff, and I usually don't go unless I absolutely have to. But I think it's because of that attitude. It's, you know, it's kind of a cloistered little world.
Interesting. Well, I don't want to run out of time. How much more time do you have? Because I want to make sure we talk about the book tour and see what you've been doing of late.
What time is it now? I've got about 5 minutes.
Okay, good. All right, so we have a little bit of time. So what did you do before this? You were in liberal work. You were a cultural reporter. How did you change to doing a Tucker biography? And what were you doing before? What kind of stuff were you reporting on?
Well, a long time ago, pre-Trump, I was in liberal media. I've always been in print. So I was always in magazines and newspapers. I was writing for the New York Times. I was writing for a bunch of liberal places. And then, you know, I sort of publicly came out as a conservative after Trump's inauguration. I got so fed
up. That must
have
been an experience.
I was just so fed up. I kept my mouth shut, like, you know, for years. I kept my mouth shut about what I believed because I felt it was unprofessional. And, you know, journalists shouldn't be on Twitter talking about how much they hate this politician or that politician. But I no longer believe that, of course. But I came out I wrote a piece for the New York Post sort of basically, you know, coming out as conservative and saying that I think my colleagues are kind of insane. And I think that I believe in free speech. And I think that a lot of the media is lying about Trump and what's happening, and they're deranged. But it was nicer than that, actually. I thought it was a pretty innocent piece. But of course, that led to me getting fired from all my jobs and blacklisted, et cetera. But that was incidentally how I met Tucker Carlson. That was my first time on his show.
Oh, interesting.
2017. And they came across the article and invited me on. And then I was a regular on the show ever since. You know, since then, obviously, I started working in conservative media. I write for The Spectator and several other places. And, you know, the Tucker biography, we started working on this about a year and a half ago. You know, he agreed to be a part of it and opened up his life and his world to me. You know, I got to know him really well, spent tons of time with him, and really just wanted to tell his story and you know, get to know him as a man. You know, he's not someone that likes that kind of attention. And he doesn't, you know, like talking about himself. So I don't think he would ever write an autobiography. I don't think that's really his nature. So, you know, people seem to be really enjoying the book. The New York Times ignored us for 2 weeks, but for the last 3 weeks we've been on the bestseller list. So that's pretty cool. They had to admit we existed finally.
it's amazing how many bestsellers don't get on the that's funny. Yeah. Well, that's activism. Okay. That's exactly the kind of activism I'm talking about. I want to get back to the story because this is fascinating, but do you see the left as it's almost like cultish in the fact that if you don't, you know, my experience of the left is my University of Massachusetts, which is very leftist. Then I went to Washington working for a consumer group, the Consumer Federation of America. And there was a fabulous man in charge of it, Steve Brobeck. He may have passed on now. I'm not sure. If not, he's very old. But, he was just fabulous and just taught me a lot about Washington, a lot about life in general. Amazing man. But the liberal groups, the group things, you almost have to suffer for the cause. In other words, you're not worthy of serving the liberal cause unless you are poor, unless you are, you know, philosophically aligned. There's like this criteria you have to you almost have to prove yourself daily that you're liberal enough to be, you know, in the group, in the club. Did you ever get a sense of that?
Oh yeah, and especially it really ramped up after Trump because you know around my whole world was liberal people, friends and everything work and you know before that I could kind of say my piece and people would be like, oh you're just trying to be antagonistic, you're just a contrarian. I'm like, no, I really believe this. Like, how do you not? But then after
Good
Trump,
point.
It was suddenly like you're a fascist, you're a Nazi, and you want me dead. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Change your opinion now. You're evil.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They ran. But it's absolutely cultish. It's only getting worse and has gotten worse. And you know, but I think more and more people are waking up to it. Of course, we say that all the time, and I think that, you know, Trump probably got more legitimate votes in 2020 than Joe Biden. Of course he did.
Does anybody honestly think that Biden, in his mentally, you know, reduced capacity, when he never did well nationally at his prime, you know, could suddenly beat the most popular president since Ronald Reagan, one of the most popular presidents ever, who had an incredible economic program, prosperity, jobs, foreign policy, military, everything else that Trump did right, that Brandon promised to reverse, and people liked what Trump was doing? Does anybody think, I mean, you don't even need election evidence at all, just on the face of it, it's impossible to believe logically that Brandon, from his basement with nobody at his rallies, could beat Trump, who had overflow crowds, you know, by the tens of thousands. That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, you're trying to tell me that New York City voted more for Donald Trump in 2020 than 2016, like 10% more. New York City, 10% more. Black Americans, Hispanic Americans all voted more for Donald Trump in 2020 than 2016. Gay Americans, gay vote doubled for Donald Trump in 2020. And you're telling me he still lost? Oh, okay. Okay, got it. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. We only have like a couple minutes left, I guess, and I want to make sure we get you out of here on time. So tell me about the book tour. What's the current status? Where's the book? What are you doing? And this is your time now. What do you want to talk about? Tell me about the book.
Oh, sure. You can get the book. You go to tuckerthebook.com if you want more information. There's also a link there to buy direct from the publisher if you don't want to give your money to Jeff Bezos or anyone. But the book's also available at which we support. You know, it might call, you know, if you want to shop at Amazon, that's fine too. We want to give people the option. We thought that was important. So you can go to, Amazon, Books a Million, Walmart, Barnes & Noble, anywhere you get your books. You know, go to your local bookstore, see if they have it, or ask them to order it. The book is it's doing great. People seem to really love it, and that's, you know, when you're writing a book about someone like Tucker Carlson, there's, you know, a lot of pressure to do him justice, and there's going to be a lot of eyes on it, and a lot of people willing to criticize it, but which is fine. But so far everyone really loves it. The reviews are great, so that's really cool.
Well, it's good for you too, because you've done an incredible job, and so now I can't wait to see what your next project is. Is another biography waiting that you can announce, or do you have another project or anything going on?
Nothing I can announce now. The wheels have been turning, and there's definitely another biography that I want to write. We're going to see if we can make it happen. That's all I can say right now.
Okay, that's fine. I understand. I have things. I don't release bills until they're done. You know, so it's the same.
Yeah.
Exactly. Do you have any more time, or do you have to go? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I got to jump off, unfortunately.
Okay, that's fine. So, any contact information, anything else you want to give? And I appreciate having you back on. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's always great to talk with you. You can find me on X mostly, Chadwick, at Chadwick_Moore. ChadwickMoore.com is a website, or you can pick up the book, Tucker, anywhere you get your books.
Sounds good. Thank you, Chadwick. Appreciate hearing from you again.
Cool. Thanks.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye
now.
That was so much fun. That's a great – I love talking to folks like Chadwick Moore. So great insights. And he was on about, I think, maybe 3 weeks to a month ago. And just – we had more insights, more depth. It was just really great to be able to bring him on and hear all these different details. We're going to take our first break. So we have time. We got Mike Clinch, Mr. Science, coming on at the top of the hour. And we're going to talk about riverboats. You know, so you want to talk about culture and eclectic and topics. You know, what have we had? We had the animal shelter we started with. Then we went to the economy. Now we're talking about Tucker Carlson and broadcasting and Chadwick Moore's book. Now I don't know why I'm going to talk. I got half an hour. I think I'm going to talk about the UAW strike. And then we're going to talk about riverboats. That's Action Radio. You just never know. You never know where we're going to go, what we're going to do, because we've got a world to cover. There's a lot of stuff going on out there. Anyway, I'll be right back. Here is your Action Radio contact and website information. The call-in line is 215-383-3832. Our show site is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Same link, live and a podcast. Please share all our shows. We have live chat at the bottom of the broadcast page available worldwide. Sign in to your free account and type away. We have an internet Skype line where you can call the show worldwide also. Please see the broadcast page for our Skype name. Call in during the show to get approved. Our bill writing site is writeyourlaws.com, WriteYourLaws, writeyourlaws.com. This is where anyone can write a bill and start the process of it becoming law. My paid and free subscription column is at gregpenglis.substack.com. Please consider a paid subscription of $5 per month or greater. For contributions to Action Radio, please go to givesendgo.com/actionradio. We have over 20 Action Radio Facebook groups. Use the Facebook search window by putting in Action Radio to find our groups. My public email is greg@writeyourlaws.com. Please contact me about advertising on Action Radio and helping our mission of freedom. Thank you for listening. This is Greg Penglis for Strikeforce, your source for pure energy. Strikeforce is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. You make your energy drink yourself. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strikeforce, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code, WYL, to the discount code window at checkout. WYL comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strikeforce is at StrikeforceEnergy.com. That's StrikeforceEnergy.com. Start your engines. Do you know your way around healthcare, insurance, pharmacies, surgery, alternative treatments and choices? I don't. Which is why I'm so glad I met Priscilla Romans, had her on Action Radio, and learned about health patient advocacy. She is the founder of Great Care. And now as an affiliate of Great Care, we are proud to offer through our discount code, WYL, which stands for Write Your Laws, a 10% discount. Great Care saves you both time and money. They provide medical advocacy, consultation, advice, and recommendations nationwide. Their website is greatcare.com. That's G-R-A-I-T-H-care.com. You can email them at greatcare.adm@gmail.com or call them at 469-864-7149. That's 469-864-7149. Great Care, better health through better knowledge and advocacy. Action Radio, part of the ADHD Radio Network, the ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed, and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio. All right, 8:36 here, Central Daylight Savings Time. Still, they're going to knock it back in a couple of months, which is crazy. We should keep Daylight Savings Time the whole year. So it's sort of cloudy, kind of misty, kind of, I don't know what it is out there, but it's we're still, you know, like summer is fighting fall, fall is fighting summer. The days are getting shorter, so it's going to get colder. So it's pretty pretty interesting out there. So what I want to talk about before Mike gets here, before we talk about riverboats and who knows what else from Mr. Science, something really interesting I heard about just before I went on the air, like about 10 minutes beforehand, and it was the strike. That's the United Auto Workers, the UAW, and I don't think this is getting the coverage it should. Well, maybe it's on the liberal networks. I actually have two stories from NPR, otherwise known as National Socialist Radio, so government-paid-for media radio doing what they want. As we know, the unions you know, are always supposed to be favored by the Democrats, but they really don't. They favor the government unions because they bribe the members of the government unions with higher contracts so that the members will vote for Democrats. I mean, that's established. We know how that works. Teachers unions, SIEU, the various government unions, that's what they do. The private unions, the Teamsters, the AFL-CIO, which then, let me see if I remember, the American Federation of Labor and the Congress of Industrial Organizations. That's the AFL-CIO or the AF of L, if you want to get technical, like these United States, which is actually more correct. That's what we're talking about here. And so it's interesting that Democrats have been pro-union, which I don't have a problem with. Private unions, I was a Teamster for years. I've got no problem with it. And so I fully advocate that workers who can join unions and get themselves a better contract, get better working conditions. That's what unions are for. Now, where I disagree with unions is when they, you know, take the dues and use it for things other than collective bargaining. And so as far as I know, some states, maybe most states, they make a distinction, or that they say that the union dues can only be used for collective bargaining, and they can do a political action fund if people want to donate for politics. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with that either. If the Teamsters want to advocate, you know, for Democrat people and spend money that they've collected independently, I don't care. I mean, I might object to it and say, hey, I think you're doing the wrong candidate. Interestingly, the Teamsters endorsed Richard Nixon, which is kind of was it Nixon? No, I'm sorry. I may be wrong. I know they endorsed Ronald Reagan. And so that's quite interesting that, you know, and the union, they want a good economy. They want jobs for their members. If their members aren't working, if the economy sucks and their members aren't working, then they're not paying dues. You know, laid off workers don't pay dues, as far as I know, if I remember. It's been a number of years since I was a Teamster. But laid off workers don't pay dues. And so and laid off workers, you know, can't contribute to unions or do things with unions because they're laid off. And what's the point? They're not working. And so the greater number of workers, the greater number of union workers, the better. I mean, I've never been a fan of right to work states. I don't believe that if a workplace, in other words, every company has rules when you go in, right? And you accept those rules or you don't. You know, it's like if you have a job where they're doing an unconstitutional COVID shot mandate, and they say, well, if you're going to work here as a doctor, you have to have a COVID shot. And at that point, you're free to say, you know, I really don't want to work there. I think I'd rather work someplace that actually honors my constitutional rights and doesn't want to fill my body with poison. And so that's your right to do that. In the same way, if there's a union, if the workers, the work rules include a union contract, which says that you have to join the union to work there, I have no problem with that either. Okay, that's just a condition of work. And so a lot of these folks who like to bust unions and bring worker wages down, which is terrible, actually, you know, they try to they want to bust the union. In fact, they're professional union busters. I've met them. You know, that's their job, is to break the union to get the cost of labor down. Now, that doesn't mean the profits go down, because the prices a lot of times will stay the same. They might reduce it a little bit, but overall, the whole point is to get labor as cheap as possible to make a greater profit, because a lot of what the cost of producing goods and services is labor. So I don't begrudge workers joining unions to get unions to get them a better contract so they make more money. You know, the union workers are the ones that, you know, have enough to get families and buy houses and contribute to the community and support the grocery stores and the shoe stores, you know, and those people can go buy other things for their family, you know. So there's nothing wrong with people making money. In fact, the unions were a huge contributor to the middle class. So I don't have a problem with this. AFL-CIO, you know, Teamsters, those are the two big ones, don't have a problem with them at all, because they're independent private organizations. You know, and if they force a contract for the company that's so bad the company can't afford it and they go broke, then that doesn't help the union, because all the workers lose their jobs. On the other hand, if they're totally wimpy and the company dominates and doesn't, you know, gives them like 5 cents an hour more than somebody who's non-union, then the union hasn't done their job. But it's not a detriment to the economy to have people, to have workers make more money. Wage, you know, and you look at what happens. Look at the big guys. So the government bails out the banks when they shouldn't. They bailed out the auto companies, Chrysler, Ford. I think they've all had bailouts. GM has had bailouts. You know, so they bail out the big guys, you know, and people, when they reach a certain level of employment, they get expense accounts, they get per diems for food, they get health benefits, they get all these different things that are on top of their salary. You know, and you're going to begrudge a worker a decent contract when you're paying your managers, you know, health benefits and travel and company cars and all this other stuff, all these benefits that don't get listed as wages. you know, well, our wages aren't that much different than the workers. Yeah, they are, because you got all this other stuff thrown in. Okay, so let's talk about, you know, let's talk about judging, you know, apples and apples instead of apples and oranges. So that's the kind of thing. So I have no problem with the workers going on strike. I think it's fascinating. But let's get into it. Now, my source, you're going to laugh, National Public Radio. All right. So I got two articles from them. And I think I can get to these before we get to Mr. Science, Mike Clinch. So the first one is September 15th. So that's today. This is from NPR, okay, and they actually have a radio station, WUWF, in other words, WUF. So WUF Radio, WUWF, it's probably University of West Florida. Okay, that's 88.1. Okay, I guess that's my local public radio. Do you think they'd have me on? You think they carry Action Radio? Nah, I don't think so. All right. The UAW launches a historic strike. At least they didn't say an historic strike, which, of course, is bad English. It launches a historic strike, so somebody actually knows who wrote this, against all big three automakers, that'd be Ford, GM, and Chrysler. And this is by Danielle Kay, K-A-Y-E. And she says, historic strike at the Detroit three automakers is now underway. For the first time ever, this is the fact that it's all three automakers are being struck. That's what's historic. She says, for the first time ever, the United Auto Workers Union is striking against all big three automakers at once after it failed to clinch a deal on a new contract by the 11:59 p.m. deadline on Thursday. This being Friday. So that was, you know, last night, right? He says, but the strike won't mean all of the nearly 150,000 union members who work at the three automakers will walk off their jobs en masse. That's French. It says E-N-M-A-S-S-E, you know, anyway. This strike is so interesting because of this factor. Okay, I'm going to get into that in just a second. So 150, think about this, 150,000 union members, right? So there's 150, that's, which is in a population of 330 million. That's not a large amount of people. But these are auto workers. These are the people on the assembly line. So these are the people, the nuts and bolts twisters. Even though a lot of cars are made by automation being, you know, that do the welds are all done by machines. So there's a lot of machine stuff, robots, AI, all that kind of stuff. So I'm wondering if they have fewer jobs. I'm wondering how many members there were 30 years ago. It might be interesting to find out. Anyway, 150,000. These are the people that probably keep the robots going. Anyway, 150,000 union members who work at the three automakers walk off their jobs. It says instead, workers at three Midwest auto plants, a General Motors assembly plant in Wentzville, Missouri, a Stellantis assembly plant in Toledo, Ohio, and part of a Ford plant in Wayne, Michigan, were the first to walk off the job under UAW President Sean Fain. Sounds like Sinn Fein, the Irish terrorist group. You know, Sean Fain, F-A-I-N apostrophe S, Sean Fain's stand-up strike strategy. So this is a new thing. It's called the stand-up strike. So in other words, targeted departments, this is very computer, this is very new age, right? Targeted departments just stop working. Now, what the NPR article doesn't tell you that I learned on One American News is that the General Motors plant is their big pickup plant. That's where they make their mid-sized pickups. It's one of their biggest sellers. The Stellantis assembly plant in Toledo, that's the Jeep. That's where they make the Jeep. Another one of the biggest sellers, right? And I've forgotten what they make at the Ford plant. That might be a pickup truck facility also. But whatever it is, these are the three most profitable, highest earning cars and trucks for these companies, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. Chrysler makes a Jeep, right? I'm not sure what Stellantis is. I have to look that up. Maybe did Chrysler sell and they didn't tell me? Anyway, it says they were the first to walk off the job under UAW President Sean Fain on his new stand-up strike strategy. We'll see if they explain it. If not, I will. It says for now, that means the strike involves just under 13,000 workers, which is a little less than, it's going to be about 8-9%, right? Oh, so there's less than 9% of UAW membership. All right, so I should just read the article. Anyway, says, but additional locations could follow at a moment's notice, depending on how bargaining with the companies progresses. A strategy intended to ramp up the pressure on companies by keeping them guessing about how their operations would be disrupted. So this is fascinating to me, all right? He says, this is our generation's defining moment, Fain told UAW members at a Facebook Live event on Thursday. So the unions have caught up to technology also. He says, the money is there, the cause is righteous, the world is watching. The cause is righteous? Well, the cause is money. No, I understand it. The unions advocate for their workers. This looks like Pianki has a comment he's put on live chat. Let's see what he says here. Oh, he's just joined the conversation. Okay, good. Pianki, you can call back in. We got Mike Clinch coming up. We're going to talk riverboats. But if you want to call back in and talk about this, I got time. Anyway, otherwise I shall continue here. This is I love that. The money is there, which I'm sure it is because they got bailed out, right? So they got plenty of, and they got COVID money. So he's right. The money is there. So Brandon and the insurrection, you know, gave trillions of dollars to companies so that their workers didn't have to work and people could sit on their butts and then vote Democrat. So the money is there. Next one. The cause is righteous. No, the cause is economic, but that's okay too. It's still righteous. The world is watching. I don't know about that, but maybe they're watching this new technique called the stand-up strike. All right. So they targeted the three most profitable car assembly lines, and the workers just stopped working. All right. Anyway, since the targeted, this is back to the article, the targeted strikes are a departure from the UAW's traditional playbook, which has usually involved having all union members at a single company walk off the job at once. Well, and then they used to go outside and go do pickets, right? They have a picket line. Don't cross the picket line. Well, what companies used to do before the National Labor Relations Act was that when the workers went on strike and carried picket signs, they'd lock the doors. That's called a lockout. All right. And then they hire a bunch of other workers to take the place of the union workers. Those are called scabs. See all this union stuff here, right? I was a teacher. Like, what can I say? I know the words. And all that to me is disgusting. You know, so they banned lockouts, and I think scabs, I'm not sure how legal it is or what the current, you know, law says, but it's really disgusting. So I tend not to cross picket lines. I tend to honor strikes because I know those folks are just trying. But you know what they're doing? Here's a line from the illegal aliens. They just want a better life, you know, and it's absolutely true, but they're Americans. It's okay. They should be advocating for a better life. So I'm with the strikers. In this case, like I say, when you've got corporate executives where their companies are bailed out, where they can't fail, where they've got expense accounts and private jets and stock options and health benefits and per diem food and travel allowances and company cars, they got all that kind of stuff, right? And you're going to begrudge these workers a little bit of a wage increase, actually a lot of a wage increase, you know, in these times of inflation caused by government spending? No, I'm with the UAW on this one. I fully support them. But gee, Greg, do you call yourself a conservative? No, actually, I don't. I call myself an anti-federalist, but that's a different story. Back to the article. The UAW has also opted to negotiate with all three automakers at once. Well, that's interesting. In another departure from his previous methods. Yeah, they used to have separate contracts. So now, well, hey, you know, they've got Facebook. That's a group event. Let's see what the automakers do. Are they going to run to Brandon and say, oh, please bail us out. The workers want more money. But how much money? This is the interesting part, is how much money. They want like a 50% raise over the next 4 years. That to me is hysterical. It says previously the UAW had picked one automaker to hash out a deal with, focusing its actions on that company until it got a deal, and then pushed for the other two, big three automakers to more or less match that deal. Yeah, divide and conquer. Okay, you know, I like this idea better. Go after all of them at once. Anyway, still, it says Fain, F-A-I-N, the person you'll see on the media a lot, the head of the United Auto Workers, the article says, did not rule, eventually, that all union workers at the big three automakers walk off the job at once. Yeah. Anyway, so let me take a water break so I can keep talking. Oh, that's better. It's amazing what a little water does to your voice. The last thing is there's a confrontational approach. Let me get to the other article. I've only got 10 minutes. I might come back to this one. But I want to start this other one here. It says, why automakers are asking for a 46% pay raise. This is from September 7th. So this is a week ago. Same person, Daniel K-A-Y-E. So she's covering the ground pretty well. She says, as a potential strike looms, okay, this is a week ago, so the strike was declared last night. So she said last week, as a potential strike looms over the Detroit three automakers, the United Auto Workers, and that's the UAW, is pushing for a substantial pay increase for its members, 46% over 4 years. What was 46%? That's 46 divided by 4. Let me do my quick calculator here because my math sucks. Calculator, 46 divided by 4 equals 11.5. So it's 11.5% pay increase every year. Now, inflation is about getting close to 4%, I think. All right. So 11.5, they're way over inflation, but inflation is scheduled to get worse. So as inflation goes up to 7%, maybe 10%, that 11.5 pay, you know, increase, you know, doesn't seem so illogical. It actually seems very logical. So what they're doing is they're locking in higher rates of pay now to compensate for future inflation. That's actually very smart. I would do it. Makes sense to me. So again, I support this contract. I say go for it. If you can get more money from the automakers, you know, considering all the amount that they spend on their execs and everybody else on the all the way down, sure, go for it. Anyway, it says it's a raise that Marcelina Pedraza, a Ford electrician in Chicago, thinks is long overdue. So this is what they do. NPR, like, let's go to the person on the street. In this case, of course, they always go to a woman. And he says, everything's going up. The cost of food, gas, mortgage, interest rates, Pedraza said. A lot of people haven't been able to have a safety net anymore. Yeah, and that's true. So whereas people used to have savings and they use their credit cards for, you know, fun stuff that they would pay off, not anymore. Now, savings are down substantially, if not gone. People are using credit cards for basic groceries, basic expenses. That's new. So the credit card debt is massively up. I guess they call it consumer debt or consumer credit, whatever they call it. It's up, and it shouldn't be, because people are doing what they shouldn't. They're using credit cards for things they're not supposed to use them for, which is just basic expenses. That's what your regular pay is for. Anyway, she says the UAW, which represents 150,000 workers, we said that. Stellantis says General Motors, Stellantis, and Ford is not alone in asking for big pay raises over the course of their contract. In recent months, and here's where it gets interesting too. In recent months, workers across industries have fought for, and in a handful of cases, won around 50% wage increases over the next 4 to 5 years, as they call out years of stagnant wages and robust company profits. Yeah, so the same companies that I'll be right back. So the same companies that were saying COVID relief, you know, we need COVID relief, you know, and mask mandates and all this other kind of stuff. The same companies that got trillions of dollars, you know, spent on them during COVID and made, you know, untold profits on all kinds of things, are, you know, don't want to pay their workers. It doesn't work that way. I'm sorry. You know, that's why you have unions to say, excuse me, looks like you made a bunch of profits and we think you should share that with everybody, not just, you know, your folks at the top. And I agree with that. All right. That makes perfect sense to me. This country will not function without a middle class. A middle class is the most important economic group, because that's the regular folks. If you only have, you know, poor and rich, you know, a whole lot of poor and a few rich, there's no freedom. You know, freedom is the accumulation of property. Freedom is a decent wage. Freedom is the ability to take your family on vacation and go out to eat when you feel like it. And some of the other things, that's American. Okay, that is the American way of life, that we have a middle class where families can do stuff together and single people can afford to do things and groups can do things. And, you know, you can go take cruises and you can, you know, buy property and maybe multiple properties. That's America. That's freedom. Freedom and property are inextricably linked. And part of freedom is getting a wage that gives you the ability to accumulate property and exercise freedom given the cost of living. So if the cost of living is so high and the taxes is so high that what you make doesn't cover that, there's no freedom. So money is freedom. Income is freedom. And that's what these folks are advocating. So this is why I have them with unions. They're basically advocating for property, for life, liberty, and property. What's wrong with that? That's American. Okay? So you look at that. I wish they'd use that argument. Maybe I should give it to them. But that's how I see it. All right. So it's this is why. Oh, here we go. So Pranky says, I worked building several plants in the St. Louis area, particularly Wentzville, Missouri, along with Ford and Chrysler. Yeah, Pranky, like I say, you got about 3 minutes, you know, if you have any insights into this. But I find this fascinating. So then it says, I'm going to get to the pilots part. I want to get the part with the pilots. So anyway, here we go. So these bold, this is back to the article, right? These bold union demands, bolstered by a tight labor market and frustration throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, which was a government pandemic. There wasn't a real one. Anyways, these are paying off some sectors with raises that significantly exceed the expected rate of inflation. Okay, let me say the expected rate of inflation for now, because there's a very good chance that as the Brandon insurrection, the illegal government borrows even more money. We talked about this with Derek, you know, an hour ago. As the illegal government borrows more money, then the Fed is going to have to buy more treasuries, you know, to send out treasuries to loan out at a higher interest rate, you know, and then they're going to have to print more money to cover their borrowing, buying of the treasuries, you know, and so the money supply is going to increase. That's going to create inflation. So again, two types of inflation: government and free market. So the government inflation, the one that starts it, is when they borrow money, spend money, and print money. So that's government inflation. Well, the prices go up. So then the workers, you know, and the unions, they try to, you know, get an increase in wages to cover the increase in the cost of living. Well, that's market inflation because that raises the prices too. So the government starts the process of inflation and raises the prices. Net effect. People want more money, which means more labor cost, you know, which means higher prices, and that raises the prices too. So you got two things working together to raise prices. The simple answer, the easy answer, the good answer is to stop the government from borrowing money. And that is exactly why I proposed a constitutional amendment that the government, you know, make it illegal for the government to borrow. So just stop their borrowing right now. But Greg, what are they going to do in a war and a pandemic? Well, they're going to do all kinds of things, but they're not going to borrow money. You know, they have to solve it without borrowing money, which means no 20-year wars, which means no, you know, Ukraine things, which means a lot of corrupt spending will stop if Congress can't borrow money because there's a lot of things they have to do. So we reduce the discretionary income and they're stuck with things that they have to do. Well, until they change what they have to do. In other words, Social Security needs to go to a private retirement account. Medicare needs to go to a private health account. Education needs to go to a private school choice account. And they have to. It's just a question of when. They have to. We can't afford these things anymore. The country's going to go bankrupt. So it's only a question of when. And as I always say, the sooner the better. Let's get to the pilot. After months of contentious negotiations that led 340,000 UPS workers. Did you know that? That there are three times more UPS workers than there are auto workers. I didn't know that. That's fascinating. 340,000 UPS workers to the brink of a strike. The Teamsters. Okay, the Teamsters are really powerful. I had a great time being a Teamster. I'm sorry. Great bunch of guys. It was like 98% men that I work with. We had a blast. It was like a brotherhood. We had so much fun. Well, and they call unions a brotherhood. I mean, that there's a good reason for that. Anyway, so 340,000 UPS workers to the brink of a strike. The Teamsters Union in July secured a 48%. You ready for that? That's almost half, right? That's almost 50%. A 48% average total wage increase over the course of a five-year contract for existing part-time workers. So in other words, a lot of times they'll make the distinction, well, this contract only covers full-time, and then they make everybody part-time, so they don't get the wages, all right? Well, you can't do that, you know? So the Teamsters, when they negotiate with UPS, and that's one of their biggest, you know, individual contracts is the UPS contract. And, of course, that goes for all the other ones. If they any part of FedEx or DHL or anybody else that's ground transportation that comes under the union. I don't think Amazon does because, you know, Amazon, for all their money, I don't think the ground folks have unionized. They should. They absolutely should. You know, I recommend anybody, if you can unionize, do it because you're only going to get a benefit. Oh, my God, you have to pay union dues. Well, would you pay, you know, $100 a month if you gained, you know, $3,000 a month? I would. It's simple economics. The cost of union dues is nothing compared to the benefits. The benefits so far exceed the cost of the union dues as to be laughable. All right. Anyway, so 48% average total wage increase over the course of the five-year contract for existing part-time workers. Teamsters General President Sean O'Brien. What is this, all Irish now? We got Sean Fain. Sean Fain is running the United Auto Workers. Sean O'Brien is running the Teamsters. It looks like the Irish have taken over. So the Irish used to be cops at the turn of the century. Now it looks like the Irish are running the unions. Oh, what a grand development. My apologies to my listeners in Ireland. Anyway, so Sean O'Brien said the contract sets a new standard in the labor movement. Oh, yeah, it sure does. In August, the Allied Pilots Association, I don't know if they're Teamsters or not. I think they are. Anyway, the Allied Pilots Association, which represents 15,000 American Airlines pilots, and that's just one airline, right? Well, it's one of the biggest. So it's probably like 45,000. If you take American, Delta, and United, that's probably most of the pilots, right? 15,000 American Airlines pilots successfully pressured the airlines to increase pilots' pay by more than 46% over 4 years. So it's about the same thing, with an immediate pay raise of more than 21%. Oh, boy. Dennis Taylor, an American Airlines 737 pilot and spokesperson for the union, said the pay bump accounts for years of stagnant wages. The last time pilots got a raise, he said, was in 2019. You know, what else happened in 2019? COVID. COVID, I think, froze wages. Then it says, it's been a long time since there have been any funding. It says, reversal of decades-long trend. So we're almost done. I'm just waiting for Mike to call in at this point. He says, last year marked the start of a notable shift. Union contracts ratified in 2022 provided workers with the highest average pay raise in more than three decades, according to Bloomberg. This is liberal. This is a liberal news source. This is National Socialist Public Radio I'm reading from. This is fascinating. This is, that trend appears to be holding up. Bloomberg Law wage data shows labor contracts ratified in the first quarter of 2023 gave workers an average first-year pay increase of 7%. So that's barely covering inflation, the highest in a single quarter since at least 2007. So, yeah, but wages have declined. So like I say, I'm all for workers doing that. Workers, hey, you guys get more wages? Go for it. That actually helps all of us. It helps the economy. Well, gee, Greg, how come if they get more money? Well, because they spend that money. You know, yeah, they're going to invest it, and that's going to help too. So when union workers, you know, making $75,000 a year, as opposed to non-union workers making $30,000 a year. So how can companies survive that? Here's a great question, actually. This would be good. Oh, here we go. Pianki says, Social Security pays survival benefits, which is always a subject for discussion. I'm against private accounts privately invested in the markets. Okay, that's fine. I'm for it. The Chilean system. So let me just say the Chilean system of retirement, which is the model for us, I believe, says that when you start work, not 15% of the money that companies set aside for your pay, but 10%. So you actually get a 5% pay increase. So 10% of the money that the company would have paid you goes into, that they've allocated to hire you, right, goes into an account that you determine where it goes. I would pick the S&P 500, you know, real general investment, right, or a mutual fund or something like that. And so at the you can't touch it. It's just like Social Security. You can't touch it until retirement age. But when you get it, it's not a government account where the Congress can change it at will. It's your own money. And it's far more, many times more than it would be for whatever the Congress has voted for a Social Security payment. See, people forget, Social Security is not your money. It's a second income tax for the government. It's social. In other words, group security, government security. It's got nothing to do with you individually. Oh, yeah, they pay you individually, but it's not. That's not what it's for. Yeah, and Pianki says union dues pay for operation costs of the union and salary for the business agents. Yeah, talk about that too. That's true. Yeah, politics, I think, should be, I think a lot of cases is a separate voluntary account. Now, I'm not going to tell you that the teams just don't heavily encourage that you donate to their voluntary political account. I'm not going to say that because they do. And they can do that, but you're free to resist it. But I'll tell you what, there is pressure. Yeah, I'll be honest with you. There's a lot of pressure in unions to donate to the political fund as a volunteer. And, of course, they get you in a meeting with everybody there, and they kind of look at you, and you go, well, you really think you should do that? And of course, you know, they always look at me. I said, look, I'm sorry, I'm not a Democrat, okay? I'm not going to support the Teamsters, you know. I'm not going to give money to the Teamsters to fund Democrats that I don't believe in. It was really interesting, and they respected me. You know, I mean, I'll be honest, that's what I said. But it was quite interesting. But I had a lot of respect for the Teamsters, and they certainly got me during the time that I worked as a Teamster, you know, the amount of money that I made and the benefits that I got and the health plan that I had far exceeded anything I would have gotten otherwise. And so that was kind of a temporary thing anyway, as I was between careers, as they say. Anyway, but it was fun. It wasn't fun. It was a lot of hard work, but it was an interesting time. All right, so middle class incomes. It is a tremendous benefit for our economy if we have a big middle class, and if that means union workers, then that's fine with me. And so these union workers, they're buying things. They're buying houses. They're taking trips. You know, they're buying food. They're supporting their families, and they can support their families because union, especially if you're like two union, you know, parents, you got a pretty good amount of money coming in. You might have, you know, $300,000 coming in, you know, or $200,000. I mean, whatever it is. But anyway, you got money coming in. Well, that money's going to be invested or it's going to be spent. If the money is invested and they buy, you know, shares in the stock market, that means the companies have money that they can spend. That's what a share is. You know, you're giving company your money on the anticipation that the company will make money and you will have a greater return as the share price increases and you make money. Or they'll pay you a dividend. And all these things go into to making the economy better. So this is why I have no problem with union contracts. Pianki says, if members don't support candidates, then Soros will. Yeah. Let Soros do it. He's free to spend money. And as long as he registers as a foreign agent and complies with the election laws and declares all his spending, I don't care. Yeah. Anyway, I was expecting Mike at this point. And so let's, in fact, let me check on it because he actually had kind of a fun topic. You know, so I'll send him a little message like, you know, where are you? Let me do my where are you message. And I might just take a break in a second. And I might just come back with, if you can't make it, then I'll just come back with other stuff. So let's see. Well, let me take a break right now anyway. So I got a couple more things to play for you. And what is it now? It is 9:07. So we'll just do another break here and cover the things I didn't cover the first break. And I'll be right back. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license.
I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Panglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com.
Well, that sounds good. Even better. Okay, how about your car? If you want the best service for your vehicle, please talk to James at Florida Stores Automotive. Conveniently located at 6715 Caroline Street in the historic district of Milton, Florida, right between the Milton Bakery and the Blackwater Trail. Whether you need an oil change or an entire engine replaced, this is the place. The phone number is 850-623-6651. That's 850-623-6651. Call, ask questions, and get the information you need. Florida Stores Automotive is a full-service automotive shop for both domestic and imports, modern and classic. It is a family-owned business here in our Milton community. Open weekdays from 7:30 to 5 p.m., Florida Stores Automotive is a convenient place to keep your car maintained and on the road. Ask them about Firestone tires and the rotation and maintenance plan. Florida Stores Automotive. I go there. You should too. All right, where's my other one here? Yeah, this is the one. I don't know how I did it, but I managed to get a 5-second gap before it started. So let's play this one now. Here at Action Radio, we are looking for sponsors. We have 30 and 60-second spots available for your announcements. And we have 3-minute live call-ins to talk about your products and services available. Action Radio is the next evolution beyond talk radio. Join us and let us help your business evolve. Think about being a sponsor of the future and not just a listener, and help us help your business grow as you help us plunge headlong into breaking new ground here on Action Radio every day. Yes, I'm typing, doing messages, and kind of all over the place here, so let me play this one now. Oh, hit the button again. There it goes. This is Greg Panglis. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio, using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system. You are listening to Action Radio Online with Greg Panglis. The webpage for all Action Radio shows and podcasts is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Please share our show with all your friends and family, both nationally and internationally. The guiding principle of Action Radio is this: we the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed. Well, that's fun. I left the thing. I didn't hit the mute button, so you probably heard me clicking away on all kinds of stuff here, and it's been rather interesting. But it looks like Mike Clinch, Mr. Science, is here. So let's get him on the line here and find out what's going on. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, I'm sorry it took me so long. For some reason, I could not get a signal in downtown Milton, Florida. I don't
really
know why, but
well, it's the historic district, so they
now
go by. No, this is historic district, so they go by historic principles. And since there was no Wi-Fi in the 1800s, that's why they don't have it in downtown Milton. I'm teasing you.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have a telegraph, so you know, I can't do that. I can't do a Lincoln, you know, we want a Gettysburg. I can't do that. Sorry.
Yeah, well, I'm not up on my Morse code, so I couldn't tap the microphone, you know, and get you a decent message. So, you know, wouldn't it be fun to do that sometime? We'll do a Morse code message.
Well, they did it on the Titanic. They did SOS.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they did.
I'm not sure it helped them.
No, it didn't, because they were too far away. Well, they were off course anyway. They had other problems. But that'd be a great show to do if you have any like untold information on the Titanic. So that would be fascinating.
Well,
I
think I shared that one thing with you, that the Titanic could actually blame those 1,500 deaths on global warming.
Well, of course it is.
If you really wanted to go
that far. Let me ask you a question that I started with when we had Tara D from our animal shelter report. I have noticed that there's been one hurricane in Florida. I mean, it was a bad one, so I'm not, you know, nothing. No disrespect to the folks in Florida. They suffered a lot. But that's only one. I mean, I remember years where there's like 10. You know, I remember when Hurricane Sally came through. And there was a year that was, Harry to the left of me, something to the right. You know, here I am stuck in the middle with Fred or whatever. There's like three of them.
1991.
I
believe it was 1991. There was like 21 or 22 main storms.
Oh, really?
And I believe if I remember correctly, that was the same year as Aaron and Opal in 1991. There were 23 main storms. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think they haven't gotten into that second set, you know, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. They use that alphabet if they go through all of the names. Because there wasn't one for Q. And I don't think there was one for Z.
They were still using girls' names at that point, right? Or did they switch over? They started using guys' names. So they only had so many names, right? So, there was no Hurricane, Barack, or Hurricane, Carter. I should have taken liberal politicians.
My sister would know that.
Okay.
Yeah, my sister would know what year this was.
So the person that named Hurricane Hillary, are they still employed, or did they ever get in the witness protection program, or what happened to them? Because that was the best name ever. That was hysterical.
They do have, they do. I can't imagine the abuse. It's just too easy. That's just too much easy comedic fodder. You know?
Oh, boy.
Unfortunately, we don't have
one
Kamala.
Hurricane Kamala, that's even better. Yeah, and we've been right after Hurricane Hillary, H-I-J-K. Yeah, you could have gotten a Hurricane Kamala in there. Well, here's a question. So here's the question I asked Tara, who's an animal shelter expert, dog and cat person. So, she didn't want to speculate, but you're the perfect person to ask this question. So if hurricanes increase with warming temperatures, does the lack of hurricanes this year mean that we actually have cooling temperatures?
I don't. You know what? My sister did a study for NOAA with the Hurricane Hunters about 15 years ago, and they found that there was really not much direct correlation.
Oh, I know that. That's a sarcastic question. No, this is a rhetorical question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is a political question.
I'm sorry.
So what I'm saying is, you notice how surprisingly silent the environmental wackos are. They don't say, look how low the hurricanes are this year. The earth is cooling. Everything's working fine. Your CO2 reductions are working. Of course, that's a bunch of crap, too. We know that. But they're not saying that.
Of course.
Because this is
no,
the proof.
No, they never say nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. But isn't it interesting?
They never say nothing.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And when you try and talk science to some people and people that have a particular view, like global climate change and all that, when you start to present historical facts and statistics and figures, they kind of go away. They go away real quick. And the reason they do that is because it doesn't fit their narrative.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the history of the Earth over the last, let's just take a couple thousand years, their history, or the history that they want, doesn't fit what is the real case.
Right.
So that's why they are so anti-history, evidence. Because when you look at the overall record, it doesn't support their narrative. So that's my view on them.
So they're silent. Yeah. Let's get to Bianchi in the conversation.
Yeah.
He'll find this interesting too. Bianchi, what do you think of all this?
Good morning, Mike. You one of my favorite.
Hey, good morning, Bianchi.
On Action Radio. But you know, climate change, what we ought to call climate change, if it hadn't been for it, then hominids would still be living in trees. Not still living there, but their delay coming out of trees would have been extended. And the reason why is because the weather caused a depletion in the trees, so they didn't have a way to, you know, maneuver back and forth from here to there. And the reason is in the trees because the predators on the ground would try to kill them and eat them. So it caused them to come to the ground. They had to develop weapons, blunt sticks. Then they learned to put points on them so they could pierce the skin of their predators, the saber-toothed tigers and so on and so on. And then Erectus stood up and started walking, and, you know, thus we have what we have, Homo sapiens, sapiens sapiens, and Neanderthals. Think about it.
Oh, and when you look at geologic history, when you start going back thousands and millions of years, there's all these places in the geologic record where you see these same types of events take place. But because nobody was here to record it, nobody was here to observe it, we only have the past evidence. If we had had scientists here for, say, some of the worst earthquakes in the United States were actually in Missouri. But that was 1811 or 1812, and there were very few people living in Missouri at that time. So you have to put all of these events in context and take a look. You know, people worry about flooding. They don't even understand the flood of 93 was bad, but the flood, and it was right at the end of the 1920s, that flood that flooded the southern Mississippi Valley, that flood is what created the Army Corps of Engineers and the water retention, the dam system, was that flood that happened in the southern Mississippi Valley in 1923? Don't hold me to that, but it was right in that area. So, again,
What about when the Mississippi froze over and people were driving their cars from the Missouri side over to the Illinois side on the river?
Oh, my mom used to live in a town called Commerce, Missouri. It got flooded out by the flood of 93, but they would walk right across the river to a town called Thebes, Illinois. It was all right there on the corner where the Ohio and the Mississippi came together. And she lived in Commerce, Missouri, which was right on the edge of the river. And they would walk across to Illinois. She said they did that a couple times when she was younger. So, yeah, that's happened. And, you know, this whole hot summer, we're going to have more hot summers, and we're going to have more cool summers. Just look at the summer Mount Pinatubo exploded again in 1991. That was a bad year. 1991, when Mount Pinatubo exploded, the northern hemisphere temperature went down like a degree and a half. And I was in the Ozarks in a cabin in August, and we had frost on our cabin. Now, anybody that's been in Missouri, anybody that's been in Missouri in August knows it gets pretty warm. But I woke up one morning and went out to go fishing, and there was ice on my car and my fishing rods. So that tells you in August. Yeah.
And so there was one time when the Mississippi River, due to earthquakes, reversed its flow. It flowed upriver, the waters did.
Yeah, that was the 1811 and 1812 New Madrid earthquakes.
Yeah. So I know about the New Madrid. It cost me at least one good water heater. So, yes, it is much, much real.
Oh, yeah, it actually is. They actually have a couple hundred quakes a year in that area. It's just that the Midwest Earthquake Consortium, they register all the quakes, but they're usually no more than 1.5. About two or three times a year, you get a 4. And that's, of course, noticed by people in the general area. And once every 10 or 15 years, it'll let loose with a 5.
What's the fault line?
5.5 that felt...
Mike, what's the fault line for Missouri?
New Madrid seismic rift is what they call it. It basically runs from a town called Marked Tree, Arkansas, through to southern Illinois. And what we believe happened, this is what the latest geology information I read, the North American continent, when Pangaea, the original supercontinent, was splitting apart, there was a weak spot right in the middle of North America. And that weak spot happens to be southern Missouri. If you look at the way if you recall the Mississippi River and the Missouri boot heel, if you take a look at the way it turns down by Memphis, that entire area is seismically active. And so changes, yeah, there have been changes. And
are they ready for it? Are they ready for an earthquake in Memphis?
Supposedly they've been planning for it for 20 or 30 years.
Okay.
There
well,
was
good.
A guy, there was a an environmentalist, his name was Ivan Browning, and he predicted, I will never forget this because it was my second or third year of teaching. It was like in 19 foot or something. He predicted a major earthquake in the New Madrid in the southern Missouri region, and he didn't have any real evidence for it. He was just predicting it. There was actually some schools in the Boot Heel area that closed. They didn't. They stayed closed for like a week because they were afraid of the earthquake. Yeah, and now, of course, he's long since gone, and his idea went with him. But it, you know, it, people don't realize they're compared to probably the greatest earthquake in North America was the Good Friday earthquake in Anchorage. That was about a 9 on the Richter scale.
That was in
the 60s? 1 to 10.
That was 60s, right?
Yeah, that was in 1964.
Okay.
Good Friday, 1964.
Oh, great timing.
New Madrid was started... I'm sorry?
I said great timing.
Yeah.
Good Friday, yeah.
Yeah, it was... Well, not for the people of Alaska. It was a bad Friday. But all kidding aside, yeah, people don't know. And all this history, all this geologic and environmental history... The environmentalist wackos ignore it. They do not talk about it. We don't even talk about it in our schools anymore. It's horrible. Our kids are getting shortchanged.
I'm getting a little bit of road. Getting a bit of road noise from you, Mike. I don't know if you can wind the windows up. It sounds like you're driving or whatever.
Oh,
it is to,
yeah. Hang on. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Hang on 1 second.
I'm kind of my own technical advisor.
Well, even a 1934 Ford don't have air conditioning.
Well, let's get Mike's noise. We'll get him to a quieter position. There we go. When did cars get air conditioning, Pianki?
Okay, there we go.
Probably 50s. Yeah, well, a little better. That's good. Okay. So Pianki was talking about cars not having air conditioning. So when did that come in?
Well, I said Mike's 1934 Ford. Mike's 1934 Ford don't have air conditioning. So.
No, that's true.
All right.
Well,
yeah.
Actually, that was a huge change.
I,
yeah. Air conditioning has made living in the South possible. Yeah.
I drove a Maverick. I drove a Maverick in high school and college, and it had 440 air conditioning, 4 windows and 40 miles an hour.
Yeah, I've heard that before. Yeah. Hey, speaking of earthquakes real quick, I was there for San Francisco's earthquake. I was in the 89 earthquake. It was
about World Series, 1989?
Yeah, it was about 7 on the Richter scale. And so if you ever want to talk about that, you know, I'm well-versed in that. And the U.S. Geological Survey is in Menlo Park, which is just down from San Francisco and is right on the San Andreas Fault. So they're located in a good place. So
it's
I am well-versed in earthquakes.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk about that sometime, that's kind of fun. We actually had a topic which I want to get to, and we can come back to this. I don't care what we talk about. It's the end of the week, and it's just fun to have you on. But we wanted to talk about riverboats for a little bit. You had an idea for historic Milton, because Milton has both a two-lane road that has to stay a two-lane road, so we don't become, we don't commit suicide, for our historic district, and it stays walkable and rideable. And the other thing is that we have a river. So we have this unique position here.
Yeah.
The river's underutilized, and the road, we need to people should use more diversions. anyway. So what's going on, Mike? Tell me the story.
People need to take a look at some historic. I grew up around the Mississippi and Missouri rivers. My family was very big into educating, learning about, since I come from a family of teachers, learning about where you live. And one of the things you learn in central Missouri is there are a lot of historic towns along the Mississippi because people coming west or a lot of the settlers coming up north, the French fur trappers and everything came north on the Mississippi or came west down the Ohio, like Lewis and Clark and others. Mm-hmm. And they established these settlements along the way. Now there's a lot of towns like Washington, Missouri, Kennesworth, Missouri. There are these historic river towns that had built up around this idea of maintaining the history of the Missouri or Mississippi River Valley.
Hmm.
So what what I think Milton could do, and I really honestly believe this. I've got a couple people that have kind of debated me about it. But I think you could have a river cruise kind of talking about the history of the area and, you know, the fact it was settled by the French and by the English and by the Spanish. You know, there's a lot of history here. And mm-hmm. you could have a river cruise like a – I know that it's not all deep enough, but you could take maybe a paddle boat, something like that, a modern paddle boat or something out into East Bay and go around and then come back to the dock right there along the highway and by the Veterans Memorial. That would be a great river spot to do that. And you could celebrate. And I had somebody ask me about dinner cruises.
Yep,
and I
that'd
said,
be great.
Well, it depends on,
booze
you know,
cruise.
If you could find some.
Party
yeah,
man.
I went on one this. Yeah, hot dog. The, I went on a river cruise on the Seine last summer. We went to France. Uh-huh. And I did a river cruise on the boat. And they had a guy that sang like Frank Sinatra on there. It was really pretty cool. And the food was not too bad either. So,
well, it better be good. It's Paris. Know, if you're in Paris on the Seine, it better be good food. That's you know, what they're known for. Yeah.
Or Milton on the Black.
Did you ever come down to St. Louis and ride the Admiral or the Hook Finn? It was paddle boats.
I did. Growing up, we rode the Admiral. The CYC, the Catholic Youth Council, used to sponsor dances once a month on the Admiral. Now, for those of you who don't know about this, the Admiral was an old, strutless steamer, and it was actually a ferry that had two levels on it, and they turned it into basically a big party boat. And so you had homecomings there. People had, like I said, the CYC sponsored dances. Oh, yeah, for years we went down to the Admiral. And it was always a great, you know, a great time, but it finally fell apart. You know, it's all good things come to an end. They finally just got rid of it a few years ago. It was sitting up north of St. Louis on the Missouri River, on the Mississippi.
And you know, Alan Cervantes, the mayor of St. Louis, owned one of the Columbus ships that was down on the riverfront, too. And, of course,
A.J. Cervantes.
A.J. Cervantes, absolutely.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
He brought the Santa Maria. It was a reproduction. And, yeah, they had that on the riverfront. And it and the floating McDonald's, unfortunately, during one of the floods, it wasn't 93, it was one of the floods before that, the floating McDonald's and the Santa Maria broke loose and, well, let's just say they had a sinking feeling. So, yeah, it was in the bottom of the river for years before they brought it up. And everybody was just disappointed about the floating McDonald's.
I want to talk about riverboats because I love riverboats. And I lived in two cities where we had evening dinner cruises, or as we used to call them, booze cruises. And so it was really popular for singles, for fun. They had live music on board. So both Boston in Boston Harbor and San Francisco in San Francisco Harbor and out of Oakland also had booze cruises. And so you'd go out 45 minutes, an hour and a half, whatever it was. You'd have sunset or you'd have like afternoon cruises. And this was huge. Now, Milton could not, I think, support a full-size riverboat. I just don't think we have the people yet. But we could support a smaller, maybe not live music, but maybe like a disco recorded music or a DJ kind of thing, you know, and we could have some fun. You could do like an afternoon family cruise and then do a nighttime, you know, alcohol adult cruise. And I think we could definitely do that in Milton.
You could do like, rehearsal, wedding rehearsal dinners, things
like
wedding. That.
You could get married on the water. It'd be available for charter.
Mike, like the Hook Finn.
Well, is there a smaller riverboat
down on the river too?
Yeah, is there a smaller riverboat? I don't know if there are like old historic ones or that maybe holds 100 people, maybe 200 at the most. Not a huge one, but a smaller riverboat where you could do a wedding on it. Where you could do, because we're always thinking of things.
Yeah,
if people think we're just talking about our little town of Milton here, just to put people in where we are. So Milton is near Pensacola, Florida. So if you're looking at a map of Florida, we're on the Gulf of Mexico. We're on the far upper left northwest corner of Florida. You know, Pensacola is the home of the Blue Angels. And so it's a beautiful area, a lot of history. Milton used to be Milltown, M-I-L-L, Milltown. So they cut trees here and they shot them down the river. Okay, so that's how Milton got to start. There were slaves here. You know, we've got an interesting history. So those are, you know, and now we have a historic district. And there's a couple of really, but the reason I want to talk about this is because a lot of towns have historic districts. There's a lot of places in this country where there is pressure to put, you know, highways through these historic districts. And the organization's called Strong Towns. In fact, I've even had the president of that, Charles Marin, been on the show a couple of times. I've got a video of his on our video, Action Radio video page, talking about you have to keep your smaller roads. You have to let people, you have to have other roads that people can take instead. Major roads like four lanes attract more traffic. They don't make you go faster. You go faster initially, but then everybody takes them. So you end up destroying your historic district. You remove your ability of people to walk. And the secret of any historic district is walkable streets, maybe even bikeable, but walkable streets and lots of retail outlets. So my plan is, and this goes for any town in the country that has a historic district, we have a river. We need to use it. We need a boat dock. We need boat facilities. We need fuel. We need easy access to the town, which you have. You just basically walk up the dock, and there it is. So we need more restaurants, more retail outlets. You know, we need more food catering for the boats so people can, like, order, you know, and get their food brought to them down at the dock. I mean, there's all these things that can happen, all right? So we got to keep our town. We need to put my idea. There's two streets. There's a really horrible intersection right at the base of the bridge that causes all the traffic problems. My solution is you put a cul-de-sac on the northern street. It's called Willing Street, W-I-L-L-I-N-G.
Yep.
So you put a cul-de-sac there, so there's no need for a traffic light, all right? You can leave the bottom street open, and you can put a cul-de-sac there, too. But there's plenty of side streets to get onto it. So you remove that traffic light, so traffic on the two-lane road can flow just fine. There's no tie-up at the base of the bridge by making one road a cul-de-sac. And so that road then becomes more
and
walkable.
And that'll make it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Pedestrian-friendly. Mm-hmm. That would make that more pedestrian-friendly route.
Absolutely. And so here's another thing. Yeah, go
you
ahead.
Go ahead. Well, no, you could do, like I said, if people will go online and look up Washington, mm-hmm. Missouri, and St. Charles, Missouri, and Kimmswick, Missouri, they will see how these towns were developed into
mm-hmm.
tourist attractions, walking areas. Now, in Missouri,
mm-hmm.
we're very lucky to have a lot of wineries in that area. That helps
mm-hmm.
tremendously. It's people coming to wineries. Down here, not so much. It's really too hot for grapes down here. So,
yeah, well, there's Emerald Coast wineries. I'd like to go to Florida because, don't forget, in San Francisco, I was a frequent visitor to both the Napa and Sonoma Valley. So we had the best wines in the world. You know, I got spoiled. I don't expect Florida wines to be the same because the stuff's not the same, and you don't have the fog, you don't have the coastline, you don't have the volcanic soil, you don't have any of the stuff that we had in California.
Weather.
Yeah, well, you had cool and hot. You had hot summer days, but you had cool nights and cool mornings when the fog rolled in. And the grapes love that difference in temperature. So you got a cool, foggy morning and a hot afternoon, then a cool, foggy evening, especially Sonoma. Sonoma, I think, has better wines than Napa. So Napa's overrated. Napa's for the heartier, drier wines. Sonoma's for the fruitier,
mm-hmm.
more the Beaujolais, the younger wines. You know, so it just
now,
depends on what
you want.
Now,
if you want a really good you really want a sweet wine, they make what's called an ice wine. They wait until the temperature when the grapes freeze.
Uh-huh.
When the grapes freeze that morning, they go out in the vineyards and they pick them all and start processing them while they're still frozen.
Really?
It seals the sugar, yes. It seals the sugar into it. It is almost like an after-dinner cordial. It's really sweet. I mean, if you like
a sweet
wine.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, if I want something sweet, I'll drink
wine.
A port.
I have not.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I can't afford.
See, well, that's if you want a sweet wine. I'm more the Chardonnay for the white wines and the you know, Zinfandels and Pinot Noirs and what's the other? Cabernet. Cabernet Sauvignon is the good one for the. Well, we should do a wine show too. We'll have a wine discussion. All right, so let's get back to Riverboat.
There you go.
So for anybody that's in a historic town and as across the country and across the world. Because there's a lot of places where towns are built on rivers because that was the transportation system. That was the highway.
Sure.
You know, until the 1900s, the highways were the rivers. The oceans, those are the trade routes and everything else. So it makes sense to have towns on rivers. So if your town has a river. And now we have three things here that would be incredible. One, Willing Street, like we just talked about. We turn one of those into a cul-de-sac. Mm-hmm. We eliminate the traffic light. That would be huge. The second thing we have is this amazing theater called the Imogene, which was built in 1912. Same year as the Titanic, that could easily hold national acts, and you're close enough to those national acts. I saw B.J. Thomas there. You know, raindrops keep falling on my head. That B.J. Thomas, he was here.
Yep.
The audience was like 5 feet from him. They could talk to him. They're asking him questions. Unbelievable place. I love the Imogene. It's haunted, too, by the way. There's spirits in there, but we'll save that for another day, too. Across the street from the Imogene, if you all visualize this, okay, if you all visualize this, across from this huge, beautiful theater is the old courthouse. Now, the courthouse needs to go into the courthouse market. It needs to become a place of shops, crazy hat shops, retail places, gourmet food shops, restaurants, and all kinds of specialty places. So you get that across, so you get the restaurant facility and the food place across from the Imogene. Now they work together. They bring in more people. We also need a parking lot.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like a three-level garage, okay? And we need, but don't let trucks come through. We got to ban the trucks. And we take Willing Street, and we get more businesses in there. And then the third component of this, so you got the Imogene, you got the courthouse. The third component is the river. So this is where we need riverboat cruises. So I think they all have to work together. Otherwise, they're not going to work. But if we can get a mid-size riverboat, and we've had boat tours going out of the river. I mean, I remember them. They were small boats, but we've had boat tours. You know, we have people, we have the, in fact, it's already started again, the bands on the Blackwater. We have free concerts every Friday, 8 weeks in the spring and 8 weeks in the fall, okay? Well, that's the perfect time for a booze cruise. So the concert starts at 7, the booze cruise leaves at 5:30. It's back by 6:30, and you walk to the concert, you know, and then you have one.
And
I
can open my winery.
Mike first, then we'll get to Bianchi, because I've been talking a lot. Mike, go ahead.
Okay. I could open up my winery right there on the main drag, right there on Willing. And have the winery open, and people come to the winery and do tastings and whatever, and purchase, and then go on down to the riverboat.
I'll broadcast from there. I would love to see if you got a wine, if you want to do a wine tasting, if you do a winery in downtown Milton, we'll call it Willing Winery, Willing Street Winery, or something like that. You know, I'll do everything I can to help.
Are
you
willing
serious.
To drink?
No, that especially if you do wine tastings on the dock on the river. Oh my God, this is great. Okay. I've monopolized enough. Bianchi, what do you think of all this?
Well, let me tell you what's down in St. Louis, and you might get some ideas.
Sure.
They've got across the river, they got their Casino Queens. It's a casino. You got a Casino Queen on the Missouri side, right at the foot of Washington Street.
Mm-hmm.
We had two small riverboats, the Huck Finn and I think the Tom Sawyer.
How big were they?
We
How many passengers?
The USS Missouri. I don't remember how many passengers. I know I wrote it, but I don't know how many passengers.
I would probably say 50 to 75. I'd say 50
to
75.
I think it would go up river.
Yeah.
I think it would go up river to the McKinley Bridge, then it turned around and came back.
Yep, and then it turned around and came back.
Yeah,
that
you remember the
perfect.
USS Missouri?
Yep.
The battleship? It was down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had
so it's and also another thing we have is horse-drawn carriages too that carry passengers and tourists.
I know
and
the
also
horse
we
person.
Have double-decker, double-decker buses with the top side open.
Okay.
Yeah,
We're not big enough for that. We're so walkable. Milton is so compressed. It's so much of a walkable city. I think the horse-drawn carriages would be fabulous. I think a 50 to 75 passenger riverboat would be perfect. I think these are all good ideas. We might even support two of them. I don't know. But certainly we could start with one and especially started offering cruises, you know, before the bands on the Blackwater concerts when we get a couple thousand people showing up in town anyway. This is great.
Yeah.
I'm going to send
you
this to the Historic Society. Yeah, this recording is going to go to a bunch of different places. This is good news. This is all good information. So keep going. Mike and then Bianchi.
You know something we need? Yeah, something we need to do, and I say this, and some people don't like it when I do, but the fact is that Santa Rosa County and the region is more than a one-trick pony. Mm-hmm. In other words, we have more than just the beaches. Because I kind of put the military in their own category. So, you know, when it comes to tourism, we're more than the beaches. We advertise the beaches. We talk about the beaches. I mean, everything's aimed at the beaches. But imagine if you had a historic river town where people could go and enjoy a glass of wine on a river like that without necessarily the crowds along the beach. I think it could be done.
Oh, I know it can be done.
I just
get the umbrellas, you know, the umbrella tables, keep you out of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'd be perfect.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'll tell you what. If I won the lottery.
No, we don't need to do that.
If I won the lottery,
this is,
it would be fun.
This is no. What we need are business entrepreneurs,
yeah.
And we need venture capital. And so, what I want to do is, I'm going to take this recording and I'll put it on the Save Historic Milton Facebook page. It's going to go on my Milton Renaissance Project, which Mike, you should join too. I'm trying to get a business association together, but they might be able to help you with your winery. You know, if you did an in-town winery, and I know people in California, I could probably get you direct connections because friends of mine were wine tour guides. You know, but it wouldn't be hard for you to make the connections. Just I can point out some really great smaller wineries that would probably love to ship you, you know, some very good California wines that would not be available because they're not the Inglenook or the Gallo or some of these other huge, you know, factory wines, Behringer, the factory wines. I know these little places.
And
so, you know,
I would carry a line of the Missouri wines from the Missouri Wine District around Missouri and Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. The reason being, so many people from the Midwest and the St. Louis area and Missouri and Illinois vacation down here. It's an 8 to 10-hour drive, depending on where you're going to, maybe 12 hours.
It's an 8 to 10-hour drive anywhere from Missouri. Come on, let's get real.
I'm from the state of misery, but... The point is, you could have those people cater to those people. They come down here and see something they know and see a Blumhof winery or something like that. And they would say, hey, that's the same company I drink in Missouri. And so you have people start coming in
that's
doing that as well. And it would be
New York State has wines too. New York State apparently has some really good wines. I don't know those at all. But it wouldn't be hard to figure them out. Yeah. Well, the good liquor store in town.
You know,
I don't think they specialize in wines. I don't know if they don't think they have tastings. But anyway, go ahead, Bianchi.
My hat's off to Pensacola, but you know, the more and more I think about it, the St. Louis area was superb. You had Anheuser-Busch, where it had its tours. You get to drink free beer. You had University City, where you had the trolley rides and all the shops. Downtown St. Louis, you had 2nd Street where they took the old buildings. They go back to the 1700s, and they turned them into shops and eateries. I mean, it's just it was something else.
Yeah. Mike just dropped, so I was going to send him a quick message, although he probably knows he dropped. So we're trying to, you know, send a little quick here. Call back. But this is all good information. Again, just to let folks know, we have a couple of different things that are available. We have the Save Historic Milton page. Anybody can go to that. You don't have to be in Milton, but see what we're doing here to preserve our town and get the economics going. And the second thing is, I have the Action Radio Milton Renaissance Project, and that is dedicated to forming a business association. I'm already talking to folks here about this, where we bring in and have an opportunity for someone like Mike, if he wants to bring a winery and a wine tasting place into Milton, this would be the perfect town for that. You know, it's small, it's walkable. You know, we've got three, you know, big things. You got Willing Street, both the north and the south side. And again, especially if we block off one of those, so there's no need for a traffic light. You got the Imogene Theater. You got the big old courthouse. You got huge fields behind it for outdoor concerts. We've got a few really good restaurants in town, and we've got this river with this beautiful dock that's completely underutilized. So this is an entrepreneurial situation just waiting to happen. And so I think that historic towns, as long as it stays walkable. And so what we're fighting is this ridiculous idea to put a four-lane freeway right through our town, build an extra bridge. It would kill the town. It would absolutely kill the town. Anyway, so that's what's going on. Hopefully, Michael joins us again.
I've got a question to ask you.
Yeah, go ahead.
How are you going to handle the crime? How are you going to have the slash and run and loot?
I don't know. I think everybody here carries.
Especially
I don't think it's a problem.
You got a large black population.
Everybody's got a gun here, Pierre.
You got a large black population in the area, like you see in Los Angeles or San Francisco. And you got to talk about it like it really is.
Yeah.
Then you got that problem. And then your police is handcuffed, so you're going to have to say police and go back to cracking heads.
Well, we don't really have that here. That's more of a Pensacola problem because they have a lot more illegals and they have a higher crime rate. Milton does not have – Milton's tiny. You know, I don't know how many people are in the county or how many people in the city. I think the city of Milton's like 11,000. And that's beyond the historic area. The historic area might only have a few thousand people living here. You know, and the actual town is probably a couple of hundred yards north of the main street, a couple hundred yards south of the street, and maybe about 300 yards, you know, from the Imogene and the courthouse to the river. It's a very small area. We're talking on the northern end of Willing. So you got East West Street. That's Caroline Street. That's the main street through town. That's the one that goes across the river. Then you've got a north and south running street called Willing. I want to block off the northern part of that street so that we don't need the traffic light. And so you're basically talking about a central block, and you've got a river on one side, and you've got about, you know, 300 yards, maybe, or probably 200 yards of stuff after that. It's very tiny. So as far as the crime problem, unless we become so big that we have a major tourist attraction and thousands upon thousands of people are coming here, I don't think we're going to have a crime problem. I just don't. But it's a good, it's an interesting thing to consider. I had not thought of that. So that's definitely something to consider. But if we get more money, we can hire more police. You know, if the town revenues are up, we get more tourists here and more businesses. I don't know. We have to wait and see what happens. You know, I'm hoping that doesn't happen. But of course, Brandon's illegals, there's a factor. What if Brandon's illegals want to take up residence in one of our, you know, not quite developed stores yet? I don't know. You know, it hasn't happened.
Well, that's what killed downtown St. Louis. The it was a crime. You had restaurants like Calico's, Mike Shannon's, Charlie Gito's, Hooters, and the Second Street, the Spaghetti House, all those had to close because of the crime.
Yeah, but that's a liberal city.
Mostly a young black male.
Well, I'll tell you,
the mosque that they built where people were moving back in, it was turning old factories into lofts. It was coming down the streets doing burnouts, donuts, and the crime that went on in some clubs there on Washington Street. We used to have street parties down there. You don't have that stuff no more.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you should say that. This is a predominantly white area. And I say that coming from an area that was everything. In San Francisco, it was everything. But we do not have a large population of young black males in the town of Milton causing high crime. You just don't. And so that's fascinating. Now, Pensacola has, I don't know the areas that well, but I think it has a predominantly black area and the crime is higher. I think they have an illegal alien area and the crime is higher. And so we know that there are populations that commit proportionally more crime, but in the city of Milton, it doesn't exist yet. And so in that way, it's kind of nice. This is sort of like Mayberry in some respects. You know, it's an older throwback. So this is the perfect place to have a town. And I don't think people here would be really tolerant of crime anyway. And they're not really tolerant of government either. It's kind of interesting that if the government programs came in, people would reject it. We rejected mask mandates before anybody else. We had a Mardi Gras parade when everybody else was outlawing them. So there's a bunch of rebels here. I think that if a crime contingent tried to move in, not only would the police go after him, but the rest of us would too. I don't think it'd really be a problem. At least I hope not.
Well, you know, in St. Louis, they have bridges. Uh-huh. They got the Eads Bridge that goes across the river into Illinois. And then you have the Martin Luther King Bridge that goes across the river into Illinois. And the police used to stop those that was coming from East St. Louis and turn them around because they, in fact, was an escape route for people that would commit crimes and death. They run across the bridge over in Illinois, believe it or not. But
well,
you
we got to
look
at County
those
Sheriff.
Things because the business are going to want to know how will we be protected.
No, it's a really good point. Like I said, I hadn't even thought of it. Probably because we don't have a lot of crime around here. In fact, the worst thing that happened to me was when these teenagers were throwing eggs at people in the middle of the night. I had to drop my car off for some work, and I had to walk home. And I was like the only person walking around because normally I wouldn't do that. Normally we drive everywhere in our bike ride. So I got an egg tossed at me. Right, this is kind of funny. And so there's Mike again. So I had an egg tossed at me, and I hit my ankle. And I looked down and went, "Damn, there's an egg." And I saw a car drive by. And I said, "I think I know who did it," but I wasn't quite sure. Anyway, they pulled into a gas station, and I looked at them, and they looked at me, and I thought, "Aha, I think they're the ones that did it." So then I started walking home, and then they found me again, right? And now they're throwing eggs at me. And so I said, "Smile." I said, "You're all on video, and I'm sending this to the police." And I had their car, and I had the taillight that was out in the back, and I had their license plate. I sent the whole thing to the police. And so I called the police and said, "I got a video coming to you guys." I said, "These guys have been throwing eggs at me downtown right now." It's like, "Oh, yeah? Really? Let's see the video." So I sent it to the – and, of course, and then you know, that was it. And within 5 minutes, they probably had been arrested. They were gone. And so I didn't have any problem after that. But so our police force is good. I mean, I know the sheriff, County Sheriff Johnson. I think – is it Tinsdale is the chief of police of Milton? So we got a good police force from Milton, and we've got a good, really good county sheriff. And so I don't think they'd put up with a high crime in Santa Rosa County. Mike, what do you think? Because this is a question of crime.
Since I was a mayor of a town and we had a police department of 10 officers, I have a little bit of experience in this.
Okay.
And it's unfortunately, I hate to say this, it's not an exact science. You would like to think that everything's perfect and everything works out the way it's supposed to.
Oh, I don't think anything's perfect, you know. Yeah.
No, you're dealing with a group of people that don't follow rules. Okay, that's the first thing you got to remember. So when you understand that they don't follow rules, then everything else just kind of naturally falls in place. Or should I say falls over, whichever the case can be. You know, and it's hard sometimes, particularly if you have – we have our community when I first started there was very poor. We had half our kids on federal free and reduced lunch, which is a lot of kids. And that's a good measure of
– Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they should be serving breakfast and lunch they should be paying for, Yeah, I like the idea of students bagging their lunch. Yeah, okay. All right. Well, how about crime, though? We only got about 6 or 7 minutes left, and Pianki raised the point, and it's true, that disproportionately young black males commit the crimes. You look at the looters, you look at the gang shootings, it's young black males. And we don't have a big population of young black males in Milton. Now, we have there's a part of Milton I know has black residents, and there's a Martin Luther King church there. I was there for Martin Luther King Day. Had a great time. It was fabulous. But the point is that there isn't a contingent of young black men looting, robbing. There's not a gang here. So we don't have that issue, which is kind of interesting, too.
I think it has to do, to a certain extent, with families. I think if you have a family, if you have an intact family unit, if you have a group of people that, you know, being a family and being involved together makes a lot of difference. It gives them a foundation. I think a lot of these folks, gentlemen, whatever, that are part of the crime, engaging in crime, I don't think they have that.
Yeah.
I don't think they have that, background.
You can't make people get married. And you know,
we think about good parents. No. Trust me.
Thinking about what we had in
25 years.
About what we had in St. Louis area, all those things are closed now. Look at Ballpark Village. They built Ballpark Village. The first day it did open, you had a shooting there, and these were black males that done that. So we got to call things the way it is, because nobody's going. Look, Charlie Gito's is gone. You got the Hooters gone.
No.
You got Calico's is gone. The only thing is left is the arch, and I don't expect it. I expect it to be missing one morning and I wake up.
And they've had people murdered in the parking garage of the arch. So, you know, I pine or cry a little bit for my old hometown, because St. Louis was such a great. If people want to know what St. Louis is like in terms of structurally, the way it looks, Baltimore is very close to it. And unfortunately, Baltimore crime is also very close to it. My son lives in Baltimore. So
well, these are Democrat cities.
Insight.
Let's be honest. These are Democrat welfare urban cities. And, you know, when Mike made the comment about families, and as I bike ride all over Milton, as I do, there's these older homes. It appears that the vast majority of residents are homeowners and their families. And whether they're black or white, it doesn't matter. These are families, long-term families. Because these are historic homes, so they're probably passed down through families. So maybe that has a larger extent.
Yeah.
And maybe because we have a better sheriff and we have a good chief of police, there just isn't a big crime. There's no roving gangs of young black men in Milton. There just isn't.
Yeah, but you have to be careful, because if you
or
say
white
there's not
gang members, you know, well,
yeah,
not that I know of. I mean, I could be wrong,
back,
but
it'll
I haven't
come
seen
back
it
to bite you.
Well, no, but we try to be honest here. We don't want to couch our language because someone might be offended. That's not true. The fact is that young black men commit the vast majority of the disproportionate crime, and that's a problem, and that needs to change, and we need to deal with that, and families are a huge part of that. But as Pianki says, you can't force people to get married, but it's a cultural thing. We as American culture need to get back to a culture that rewards families and has incentive for families over single parents. I mean, that's probably the single greatest deterrent to crime right there. Is to not make welfare pay for single parents over married families. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
And
so Milton,
that support each other.
But is Milton, I don't know what the racial makeup of Milton is. I'd say it's mostly white. And it's like I say, it's an old Mayberry town, but I think it's either white or black. I don't see a lot of Asian folks in town here. The closest would be the Filipino and the Vietnamese shrimp fishermen, but they're more Pensacola. But it's really interesting. This is a really white town, you know, compared to San Francisco. And I remember when I first got here, it's like, where's everybody else? You know, where are all the other folks I'm used to? You know, where are the Hispanics and Asians and the black people? You know, it was kind of funny. So it's just, but it is a peaceful place. I don't see this area. It's not big enough. I don't see the gang situation here. Like, I don't know what's underground. You know, who knows? And who knows what the illegals, what Brandon's illegals are going to do if they start locating in Milton.
Well,
we're going to have a problem.
Now, remember.
Big problem.
There have been a lot of those apartments in Pensacola. They've had some issues with shootings there and some murders.
Are these housing projects or are these private apartments?
Well, they're Section 8, as far as I know. There
Section
were some
8?
Issues with some of the – yeah, there were some issues with the people who were managing the complexes,
uh-huh.
and people were you know, coming around that shouldn't have been around. Non-residents, let's put it this way. Non-residents.
Okay.
And, yeah, that's something you have to watch out for. Now, we never had that in my city. We didn't have – we had mobile home parks, which is a whole different story. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to kind of watch the top to bottom. You have to kind of be situationally aware when that kind of stuff is going on because just when you think you've got it nipped in the bud, it can come back to haunt you.
Yeah, but Pensacola is probably more liberal than Milton is. You know, we're just 30 minutes away. But
we are
predominantly Republican, predominantly conservative, predominantly a family values mm-hmm. area. You know, we are a law and order kind of place. Like I say, a good sheriff, good Milton police. This is like Mayberry. This is like going back, you know, 50 years. It's kind of interesting. So this is the perfect place, being the peaceful place that it is, for developing, you know, a historic area that could be historic. You know, with National Axe at the Imogene, with, you know, a gourmet restaurant facility at the old courthouse, with a river area with riverboats and free concerts and, you know, all the other things that are, and more restaurants and more places for people to come and different, and your winery with your wine tasting. I mean, this would be, and plus Action, the home of Action Radio. You know, the potential
yep.
of this area is staggering. And yet, I think our city council gets in the way of that. I think that we have the old guard people that don't want any change of anything. They want things to stay exactly as they are. And then you've got the contingent mm-hmm. that wants to destroy it so they can shorten their commute by 10 minutes, you know, instead of picking a different
yeah.
day, different time, or different route. You know, that want to put a massive freeway through our historic district. So that's what we're fighting right now. And that's what needs to
change. Know.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
My impression is, Greg, they want a quick way to avoid I-10 to go from Milton to Pace.
Yeah,
that's what this whole thing is
they're
about.
They're so selfish because the people that want this big four-lane don't live here. They want to go through.
No.
They just want to drive through the town
no.
faster. Well, that's selfish. That's yep. unbelievably selfish to me. Go around. As
yep.
I say,
you know
Milton,
what?
Drive to.
On.
Yeah, Milton, drive to, not through. Go ahead, Mike, and then we'll get Pianki's
yeah.
comment. Go ahead. Big comment.
Yeah,
sum it up.
They need to put a third lane on I-10. I'll leave
yeah.
it at that. There needs to be a third
Absolutely.
Lane on I-10. Yeah, going from the border, basically, all the way through
yeah.
from Florala and the Alabama border, all the
yeah.
way through to 10 to 15 miles the other side of Destin.
Yeah,
and
three lanes each direction.
Uh-huh.
Do you know how long it takes to get
yep.
from Caroline Street, which is 90, down 87? Do you know how long it takes to get to I-10, which is this huge interstate freeway from Caroline, the road that they want to extend?
I just got done driving that.
2 minutes.
Believe it or not. I'm talking to you, and I just got done driving it.
It takes 2 minutes.
Yeah, there wasn't anybody.
Yep. It takes 2 minutes to
there
go from Caroline to a major interstate freeway. 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm. But they want to,
and for
they
that,
want to make it more quote more convenient for the
yeah,
Pace
they want to destroy
people.
Our town. These people can't take 2 minutes to drive down to the interstate freeway, and then it takes a little longer to get back. Maybe it's like 5 minutes to get back to Caroline Street from the other side of Milton.
Yeah,
but you got 2 minutes one way, you got
oh,
five
yeah,
minutes the other way, and for that. For that, they want to sacrifice our town with a four-lane freeway? No.
And this is, and let me tell you a little secret. This act, there's a connection here. Okay. You know, the TPO, the Transportation Planning Organization, I've sat in on their last two meetings about how the money is divvied up for the, the five-year transportation plan. There was not one state legislator either of these meetings. They were making decisions on millions of dollars of state money going for road improvements, and nobody, no Senator Broxson, Alex Andrade, Joel Rudman, none of them were at either of these meetings. And I
were they allocating,
called out.
Huh.
Yeah.
Were they allocating money for Milton?
Leaving a 5 year.
So
well,
did, are they trying to spend money on sacrificing our town with the freeway or no? Is that a priority or no?
There's plan. There's money in there for PD&E, you know, planning and development and engineering. Yeah, you can find this all on the website.
Okay, but are they actively interested in destroying our town with a freeway, or is it like a back burner, low priority project?
I got to be honest with you. I think they're keeping it low priority.
Good.
Visually.
That's good news. So what we need to do, is get as many businesses as possible to make it as difficult as possible for them to four lane it. That's what we need.
And you know, and you have to apply pressure to the elected. You got to apply pressure to the elected.
Drive
two,
okay, one
at
a time,
through.
Guys. Yeah, drive two, not through. Yeah, let's get Pianki then Mike. So Pianki, you got a comment?
Yeah, I'm getting ready to get off and pass time, but no, drive two, not through. That's a great slogan. That's a big sign that you should have leading to the way. That way, people can say,
I've been trying to get a bumper sticker. Yeah, Milton, drive two, not through. Yeah. Well, let me talk to you next week. And Mike, you want to sum up?
Yep. Yeah, I was going to say when these kind of efforts, the efforts that we need in places like Milton, it takes more than one or two people. When I was during my short campaign for county commissioner, I went and talked to several people, Kim McCarthy and some of the other folks up there in Milton, because I wanted to find out the whole county what the feeling was. And the feeling was that Milton's just kind of, you know, since they built the new courthouse and everything way out of downtown and everything else, they kind of forgot it. I don't know if it's deliberate, but I think their focus has changed. And they're looking at that's on the way to pace. Everything's about pace. Everything's about Escambia.
Yeah, well, you can keep pace. Sorry. But we do have new businesses.
Slower pace.
You know. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
in Milton, we've got, just to let folks know, we've got, Beardless Brew House is back open. We've got the Bistro Restaurant. We've got Brew Angels in the old post office. We've got Gulf Coast Garage, which is a brew pub in an old gas station. We've got a new place, the Sweet Greek. You know, we've got a wonderful new liquor store with some pretty classic stuff. We've got Boomerangs. We've got the hair salon. We've got a new country gym. We've got free concerts. We've got this amazing potential with the courthouse. And we've got amazing potential with the Imogene Theater and amazing potential with the river dock. We just have to start developing these things, keep the area historic, you know, follow the Strong Towns plan of walkable cities with retail outlets, and we'll be fine. That's it.
Hopefully you have some folks there in town that will take that bull by the horns and go with that. Because
well,
it usually takes a couple people. It takes two or three people to push that.
Yeah.
And they,
well,
you know,
did you ever read my
growth
plan? Did you ever read my growth management plan for the area?
No, I'll
send it to
you. No, send it to me again.
Yeah.
I'm almost positive you sent it to me before. Yeah, if you get a chance.
I know I did. You'll give me your old email, so that's okay. All right, we got to go.
All right.
Any announcements, anything?
Okay, looks good.
Last word, or are we done? I guess we're done.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Mike. Mike Lynch,
Mr. Science.
All right,
thanks, Greg. You take care. Pianki, take care, bud.
Oh, he's already gone. But we need to give you a closing so you can say, this is Mike Lynch, Mr. Science for Action Radio. Let's give that a try.
Okay. This is Mike Lynch, Mr. Science for Action Radio.
Oh, that's perfect. Okay, keep doing that. That'll be your new slogan for now. All right. Thanks, Mike.
No, because I did radio for 4 years. Remember, I told you about that. I was on radio for 4 years in San.
Well, then make up your own clothes.
Hey, this is Mike the Scientist. Watch your temperatures.
Okay, you sound like a radio guy. Hey, I got my radio voice on now. Yeah, it's a beautiful day in Milton. It's sunshine.
Hey,
it's
I was the voice
yeah,
of 99.9.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
K-F-A-B. Yeah, I did some
K-Fab. We're a K-Fab. We're fab. Sorry.
No, B. B is in Victor. K-Fab. K-Fab, not K-Fab. Sounds
K-Fab?
Like a laundry soap.
Hey, man, we're like fab,
yep.
You know, we're like totally fab. Okay, that's great, yeah.
You're
we're
my
your
fab
fabs.
Person.
Yeah. Get out of here, Mike.
All right,
talk
I'm getting out of here. All right, bye.
Later. Okay, bye now. This has been an incredible week. Just look at today. You know, we had Tara D. with the Animal Shelter Report. We had Derek Park, Financial Report. We had Chadwick Moore, our special guest, the author of Tucker. I ranted and raved about unions for about half an hour. And we had Mike Lynch, Mr. Science, you know, with his radio voice in the end there. This has been fun. Anyway, I played everything I have to play. So I'm just going to close with our classical piece of the deal on every Friday. And I'll just tell you next week, it's going to be interesting. I've got the memo that the occupation government in the White House was sending out to all the media outlets to take away their First Amendment rights and tell them what to say about impeachment. That's going to be Monday's show. Tuesday show, who knows? Things can happen between now and then. Anyway, have a great weekend. Stay positive. Stay patriotic. Do what you can. And I'll see you all again Monday morning at 7 a.m. Central Time when we shall do this all again.